some briefs about how far the air processes are. But we should hope that by when we reopen next term, we will be finalizing MPRDA. It's long overdue. It's been sitting before Parliament for a long time now. And I will therefore, without wasting any time, I'll give the Minister to lead us to just say a few words on these pieces of language.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether I'm the highest minister or what is going on.
Oh, you did. Oh.
I can't even reach the mic. Thank you very much, Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, members of the media. We are here at the request of the Portfolio Committee to give the Portfolio Committee a briefing on the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act. They are actually requested us to talk to the principal act in view of the fact that they will be dealing, and they are actually dealing, with the royalties bill. So that's the reason why we are here, but we will be talking to other issues on legislation. But sadly, for the media, we cannot give the detail on the other pieces of legislation because they still have to serve in cabinet. Yes, we will make mention of those we have decided to take to cabinet, but we can't speak to the detail of those pieces of legislation before they serve in cabinet. But I may also talk to what has been already agreed to by Parliament, the long-awaited amendment of the MPRDA, whereby we were proposing amendments for environmental purposes. We were being asked to improve the positions and the provisions on environment as they stand in the Act. I'm sure you know that it has been a long protracted debate between ourselves and the Ministry for Environmental Affairs and Tourism. And we then ended up coming with this position, which I will report to the Portfolio Committee. We decided on the following, which is a consensus. It is a product of a consensus between the Ministry of Environmental Affairs and the Ministry of Minerals and Energy. We are saying which will be the amendment, the actual amendment, that one environmental management system must be followed. We all agree that that should be the case. But given the uniqueness of the minerals and energy, especially the minerals aspect of what we do, when we request people to apply, the requirement, the main requirement, one of the main requirements is that they must include in the program, in the application, their plan for managing the environment. It's linked to the application in the sense that if it is not, that environmental management plan is not part of the application, and I'm talking the detail of that plan, has to be included as part of the application, then we do not approve the application. That's the first thing that is important about the EIA. So But because then we are confronted with a lot of applications, we felt that we have capacity for processing these applications. And it's something that we agreed on ourselves and the Minister of Environment, that for processing these applications, it would be difficult for us to separate the EIA from the application as a whole. We treat it as a package, and we treat it as being obligatory. It's obligatory for all applicants to include the EIA. And given that up to now we have been operating in that manner, we agreed that that should remain with us as DME. While we are looking at one system of environmental management, meaning that whatever is contained in the MPRPA will be in line with the NEMA. But at the same time, in terms of the practical processing of the EIAs for DME, we retain that function. Then, as a result of that, we said the Minister of Minerals and Energy must be the responsible authority for the environment as it relates to prospecting, mining, exploration, production, or related activities. That's the second amendment that we proposed. The third thing, again, in line with the fact that we have all of us to comply with the NEMA, then for that reason, given that we want this one system for environmental management in the country, but looking at the uniqueness of the mining industry. But then we said that the Minister of Environmental Affairs and Tourism must be the responsible appeal authority on all environmental authorizations issued in terms of the NEMA. So while we will be processing this applications that would include the plan or the program for environmental management, the appeal authority, if anything goes amiss, the Department of Environmental Affairs comes in. We also said in this system, the Minister of Environmental Affairs will be responsible for drafting and promulgating all environmental policies and legislation in terms of the NEMA. That responsibility still remains with the Ministry of Environmental Affairs, given that this is the core function of the... So it's just in line with that. The third thing that will be taken in as part of the amendment of the MPRPA is that the Minister of Minerals and Energy will be responsible for implementing environmental policy and legislation in terms of NEMA and specific environmental legislation as it relates to prospecting, mining, exploration, production, and related activities on a prospecting, mining, exploration, or production area. It's still in line with what I said earlier on that we were dealing with these already. We do have the capacity, something again that was acknowledged by the minister. And as a result, then we agreed that this is how it should be. Then the result of this would be that both the MPRPA and NEMA would be amended, including the specific environmental legislation, such as NEMA Air Quality Act, NEMA Waste Management Bill, and the NEMA Coastal Management Bill. Also, environmental requirements in terms of the MPRPA and its supporting regulations would be deleted from the Act, and it would be incorporated into NEMA. In other words, it would be deleted from the MPRPA and it would be included into the NEMA, including environmental requirements. In other words, the MPRPA amendment bill would then have those amendments. The time frames for processing and approval of EIAs and EMPs in the MPRPA, they will be retained in the NEMA. The Minister for the DIT remains an appeal authority for all of these environmental authorizations. And the Minister of DME will be responsible for handling appeals on decisions leading up to the environmental authorization. And we decided that a transitional period for establishing one environmental system is 18 months from the date of the last bill to be enacted. I will leave it at that. If my officials have anything to add, I will allow them to add before I get to the second aspect of the MPRPA. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Minister. I'll allow, as the Minister has suggested, if there are any people from the DME side who want to add what the Minister has said.
Thank you, Chairperson. We would just like to indicate that it actually gave us a long period of discussion with the officials from DIT, the whole issue around the appeal authority. Because in terms of practical implementation, it does seem to present some challenges. But we're hoping that with the split that we've achieved, well, we think that we've achieved around the decision leading to the actual authorization versus the authorization itself, but as the Minister has indicated, that would work. The other thing, as the Minister has indicated, the issue of 18 months and the transitional period, which we have indicated in the agreement between the two departments, that we need this time to be able to implement what needs to be implemented, as a transitional means to get there. But it also says that we need to ensure that the two bills, the amendment bills, the NEMA one and the MPRPA amendment bill, actually go together, so that if there's something that is left, or maybe the agreement is not properly implemented in the NEMA amendment, that we still have the opportunity to make sure that this happens in the MPRPA amendment. We are concerned that, at this point in time, maybe we do need to have some policy changes to incorporate this agreement. But we will see how the process unfolds in the coming few months, and then we can take it from there. But at this point in time, here we are with the amendment, with the whole process as it reached a stop sometime in the middle of last year, and here we are now.
I will ask a 42 take us through the summary of the proposed amendments, so that we can have a sense of how they would appear and what it is that we're talking about, even for the benefit of the people who are here, the media especially. Who would want the detail. I think it's important that we speak to the detail.
Thanks, Minister. I am going to ask, with your permission, Minister, one of my colleagues who is going to do the actual presentation, and then I'll be supporting here with additional information.
Honourable Minister and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, we have distributed a table which is very clear on a summary of the proposed further environmental amendments to the Mineral Petroleum Resources Development Amendment Bill. and I'm sure everybody probably has a copy, and that is a bit more clear than the table in the presentation. Now, just on the long title of the MPRDA Amendment Bill, we have amended the long title to say that amendment of the MPRDA Amendment Bill is amended so as to make the minister the responsible authority for implementing environmental matters in terms of NEMA and any of the related or specific environmental management legislation as it relates to prospecting, mining, exploration, production activities, or activities incidental thereto on a prospecting, mining, exploration, or production area. The next purpose is also to align the Mineral Petroleum Resource Amendment Bill with NEMA in order to provide for one environmental management system, and then to remove ambiguities in certain definitions, to add functions to the REMDEC committees, to transform the designated agency, to amend the transitional arrangements so as to further afford statutory protection to certain existing old order rights, and to provide for matters connected thereto. So a very long title, but I think it's descriptive of all the amendments that we would like to make. Now the second one, clause one, and we have included some of the amendments in the amendment bill. The definition of community was debated in the public hearings, and we want to retain that, and we also want to duplicate that in NEMA because we need to promote participation of communities as it relates to mining. Clause 1, also of the MPRDA Amendment Bill, page 3, the definition of effective date. We have added the condition of environmental authorization. Therefore, effective date in terms of the MPRDA means the date on which the relevant permit is issued or the right granted, registered in the Mineral Petroleum Titles Registration Office and executed. An environmental authorization issued by the Minister, and that is the Minister of Minerals and Energy, in terms of NEMA, shall be a condition prior to the issuing of a permit or the granting of a right. Page 2. Clause 1, MPRDA Amendment Bill. Definition of environmental authorization. It was necessary just to provide a definition there as well. Means the authorization issued by the Minister of Minerals and Energy in terms of NEMA. And then Clause 1, MPRDA Amendment Bill, definition of environmental reports. Now, we couldn't really capture all the different reports as required in terms of NEMA, so we just mentioned in terms of the MPRDA Amendment Bill. Environmental reports mean reports required in terms of NEMA in order to inform and support the environmental authorization to be issued or amended by the Minister. For specific rights, different reports are required. For instance, a prospecting right will require a basic assessment and an EMC. A mining right application will require a scoping report, EIA, and EMC. So that's why we just defined reports. What should be deleted from the MPRDA is definitions on the environment, environmental management plan, environmental management program, and financial provision. Those definitions will be incorporated into the NEMA Amendment Bill. On page 3 of the summary document, clause 1, MPRDA Amendment Bill, page 5, the definition of the minister in terms of the MPRDA we need to change. The minister means the Minister of Minerals and Energy in terms of this act. In relation to the implementation of environmental matters in terms of NEMA for prospecting, mining, exploration, production and activities incidental thereto, on a prospecting, mining, exploration, production area, it means the Minister of Minerals and Energy. So we just added that clause also to the definition of minister. Then we needed to add a definition of NEMA, means National Environmental Management Act, as amended, and including any related and specific environmental management legislation to be amended and promulgated from time to time. Now, that means actually the NEMA Air Quality Act, the NEMA Waste Management Bill that will become an act, the NEMA Coastal Management Bill, in terms of those pieces of specific environmental legislation, the Minister of Minerals and Energy will also retain her jurisdiction on environmental matters, implementing environmental issues in terms of those specific pieces of legislation as it relates to a prospecting area and a mining area. Just to provide some clarity, Clause 4, that was also a deletion, the general exclusion of NEMA, that was from the previous bill. And then on page 4 of the summary, the prohibition relating to illegal mining activity, just to indicate that it's a new insertion, and just to indicate that 5 capital A, we have replaced that with the environmental management program, we've replaced that with the environmental authorization. Section 5 of the MPRDA, we've replaced program and plan with the approved environmental authorization in terms of NEMA. On page 5 of the summary, I've just summarized similar amendments. Section 16, 22, 27, 74, 79, 83 of the MPRDA. Any person who wishes to apply to the Minister for Minerals and Energy for prospecting rights, or mining permits, exploration rights, or production rights, must simultaneously apply for environmental authorization. During our discussions with the Department of Environment Affairs, we indicated that we don't want too many application procedures. We want one application procedure to make a procedure very effective. So if you apply for those rights or permits in terms of the MPRDA, you will simultaneously apply for the environmental authorization as well. And in all these clauses, the regional manager accepts the application, and then after 14 days from the date of acceptance, notify the applicant in writing to submit relevant environmental reports required in terms of Chapter 5 of NEMA. And I have included a 60 days or a 180 days, we're going to retain the time frames as in the MPRDA, because that's very important for the DME in order to process applications effectively. And then the B part is to consult in the prescribed manner with the landowner, lawful occupier, and any interested party, and include the result of the consultation in the relevant environmental report. So we have actually taken away the EMPs and the environmental management plans and the writing in brackets. The next amendment, section 17, 23, 75, 80, and 84. One of the criteria that the Minister of Minerals and Energy used in making a decision on granting a right or issuing a permit in terms of the MPRDA was that prospecting or mining will not result in unacceptable pollution, ecological degradation, or damage to the environment. That was one of the criteria for the Minister making a decision. That is now replaced by an environmental authorization is issued. Page 6 of the summary document, Sections 18, 24, 81, 85 of the MPRDA. That relates to applications of renewal of prospecting rights, mining rights, exploration, production rights. We have just taken out the requirements for the approved environmental management program, the application to complete it, the estimated cost thereof, and we replace it with that. This application must be accompanied by a report reflecting the extent of compliance with the conditions of the environmental authorization. And the second part is also we've taken out requirements of the approved environmental management plan or program, and we've replaced that with compliance with the conditions of the environmental authorization. The same with the next amendments, sections 19, 25, 35, 82, and 86, rights and obligations of permits and rights. We have replaced requirements of the approved environmental management program with the conditions of the environmental authorization. Section 37 of the MPRDA is about the environmental management principle. We're going to retain that, and what we did is we just included activity in order to read, apply to all prospecting and mining operations as the case may be, and any matter or activity relating to such operations. Remember, we talked about operations and any related activity, like roads, a railway on a mining area, etc. If we page to page 7 of the summary, section 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 45, 36, 107, 1A, Roman 1 to Roman 8, all of these were suggested that we delete the entire section from the MPRDA and that to be incorporated into NEMA. But on a closer look at all these requirements, we need to retain some of these requirements. For instance, if we just talk about the issuing of closure certificates, it's not just about environmental issues. Closure is being issued by the Minister of Minerals and Energy also in terms of mine health and safety requirements, the mineral laws requirements, social and labor plan issues. So we need to retain the issuing of a closure certificate somehow, and also perhaps the minister's powers to recover costs in the event of urgent remedial measures, because that relates to implementation. So not all of that sections are just going to be deleted. We need to contextualize what should be incorporated into NEMA and what should be retained in the MPRDA. And for instance, the minister's power to remedy environmental damage in certain areas is about derelict owners' mines and rehabilitation of derelict owners' mines. That is the executing function anyway, and we need to contextualize what should be incorporated into NEMA and what should be retained. With regard to 107, that is provisions to make regulations on environmental issues, and that can probably be incorporated, deleted in the MPRDA and incorporated into NEMA. With regard to residue stockpiles, 42, and residue deposits, at first the Department of Environmental Affairs thought that they should put this into the NEMA waste management bill. But this is a very important aspect of managing a mine. If something goes wrong with residue deposits, it's actually disastrous. So we actually requested them to put it up into a general provision in NEMA, which was then done. Section 47, if we proceed, that is about contravening, and we just replaced approved EMP with conditions of the environmental authorization. Section 48 of the MPRDA, the National Parks Act have been replaced by the NEMA Protected Areas Act, and we will make that amendment. On page 8, section 106.2 of the MPRDA, that was exemptions to organs of state, but despite that we exempt them from applying, we don't exempt them from providing environmental reports. So organs of state so exempted must submit relevant environmental reports as required in terms of Chapter 5 of NEMA to obtain an environmental authorization. So all, in summary, all the proposed environmental amendments is captured, but I think we need to still contextualize on the ones that to be deleted, what we should delete and what should be incorporated into NEMA and what we should retain. For instance, the Minister of Minerals and Energy is the minister that issued the mining right, and she's the only minister that can actually close, provide closure to that right. And also with regard to appointment of people to take over liabilities, she's also the only person that can appoint a person, a competent person to take over liabilities should the mine not be wanting to remain responsible to take over those liabilities. So in summary, Honourable Minister and Honourable Members, that is a summary of all the proposed amendments.
Thank you very much for the input. I think members have really at least got the detail of what is entailed. I will therefore allow some interaction probably of the members at this stage if they have any need any clarifications or whatever. I have Honorable Schmidt here. Anybody who thinks who has better the response can respond from the delegation of DME.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, insofar as the amendments intend to make the procedure more. What's the word I'm looking for? More straightforward, more user-friendly, I hope it is. I'm also concerned about the fact that on the face of it, where we have defined criteria, strictly defined criteria, such as in page 5 of your slide, section 172375, you delete the section which says the prospecting will not result in an unacceptable pollution, ecological degradation, or damage to the environment, which is just replaced by a very general statement saying an environmental authorization is issued. Now, one can read that those criteria will be included in the environmental authorization, but the Act does not prescribe it. So, you know, somewhere else there should be checks and balances, maybe there are, to include those criteria in the environmental authorization. In other words, to make it that you can only authorize or have an environmental authorization issued when those criteria are, in fact, adhered to. So I'm not sure whether someone actually does it, what I've just suggested. And secondly, do you foresee any problems in terms of NEMA or the DEET being the appeal authority? Because we have one department dealing with the whole process, as I understand it, and only once the procedure has been completed in terms of NEMA and the environmental authorization, will the appeal authority be the Minister of, I suppose, Minister of Environmental Affairs? Do you foresee any problems in terms of time, in terms of time needed in order to resolve the appeal? Because now we have a total new department who will then have to, I suppose, rework those issues and inform them, Minister, as to what the correct outcome of that appeal should be. So I do foresee, you know, it's one thing having one department working with the whole procedure and then having all the things at their fingertips and then referring it to their minister as in terms of a decision. So it's a concern related to time. It's not a concern related to procedure. Yeah.
Honourable Chair and Honourable Member, with regard to the first input on the criteria, and that we shouldn't lose unacceptable pollution, ecological degradation, damage to the environment, I think what we should do there is to make sure that that wording is captured in the authorization. So it automatically becomes a criteria that they need to comply with. On the appeal authority, as my Deputy Director General indicated, we have debated this at length, and there's a lot of practical problems. We suggested then, as a way forward, that the Minister of Minerals and Energy, say, for instance, there is a appeal against the acceptance of an EIA or EMP, then the Minister of Minerals and Energy will deal with that appeal against that decision. But with regard to the criteria given to us by the political leaders, it was that the Minister of Environment Affairs must be the appeal authority on all environmental authorizations. And maybe the thinking was that it was a good thing so that you become the ultimate responsible political leader for handling appeals on the environment. But I think with regard to time frames, it could take a lot of time to deal with an appeal eventually. There's a lot of practical problems that we still need to sort out, but we recognize your concern.
Can I just make one point on the issue of the appeal authority and it being the appeal authority ministry? That it's more about ensuring national standards, that all of us adhere to national standards, but also that all of us comply. But we had to appreciate, as I said earlier on, that you have a unique situation where the processing of licenses is linked to the environmental management plan as a condition and as a requirement. If people do not comply in their application with the environmental management, then we don't issue a license. And whatever we require from the environmental management plan, in letter and in spirit, is what comes of out of NEMA. It is a NEMA position. We took what was NEMA and put it into the NDRP. So there's not really a contradiction in terms of the compliance on our side. And I must say that we have not been found wanting in terms of meeting the requirements of the NEMA in the course of processing our application. But I think because the ministry had to ensure all the time that we all, you know, follow the NEMA in whatever we are doing whenever we are involved in issues of environmental management. And I think this is the reason why we decided to have the minister as the appeal authority, given that it is the core function of environmental affairs and tourism. I must say that it was a very difficult decision to arrive at. But it became apparent that the capacity within the DIT to deal with environmental management plans as they come to or as they relate to minerals, mining, prospecting. I mean, we have a processed over 13,000 applications, over 13,000 applications from 2004 after the promulgation of the MPRTA to date. And it's clear that DIT wouldn't have had the capacity to deal with it. And I mean, one application is voluminous. It's a volume of documents that include the MPRTA. But the MPRTA has become a condition, including your BEE, your social, those three, social labor plan, BEE, and your EIA. If people do not comply, we reject the application. It's a condition. We don't compromise on that. And I think we did then appreciate that over time we've had this experience of processing without them complaining that we were not complying with the NEMA. So they agreed that that function of processing applications, plans, environmental management plans as they relate to us, the allow that to remain, that function to remain with us.
I hope I've been clarified. Yeah, okay. Yeah, they also...
But there is one challenge which I should speak to, maybe my officials would want to see me. The one challenge, if we were to give over, very important because you asked me, that function, it would lead to what was the complaint just when I got into the department, that the processing of licenses and applications was a slow process. Now, if you then take this function and hand it over to a situation where there is no capacity, then that's a recipe for disaster in as far as those delays are concerned. I mean, you'd go back to square one, where you'd experience the delays, which are not really needed. And it would affect the investors and all of the effect of it. That would be negative. So we agreed that it should remain with us.
I have Aurora Mochivera then.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Minister, for your explanation, and thank you for the presentation. I've got just one on the amendment, Section 76, at C, with the subsection 3 of the following subsection. If the application does not comply with the requirements of this section, the designated agency must notify the applicant of that fact in writing within 14 days of the receipt of the application and return the application to the following. I just wanted to know what's going to happen if that person does not get a response within 14 days, a written response within 14 days. What's going to happen then? Thank you.
That is already, Chairperson, that is already a ground, you know, for coming back to the minister and saying, you know, and complaining about that. Because the law is clear, it says 14 days you respond. You say you're accepting or rejecting the application. And that, we can say that with the business processes and the NMPS, which is our computer system, we're actually able to calculate the number of these days, and you know that within these days you're supposed to send it out, because otherwise, then in terms of Section 96, then the applicant, if your response is not within that 14 days, then it's a ground for them to go to the minister or to the people to appeal again that they didn't get it in time, that you didn't respond on time.
Are you happy with that, Matuel? Okay. I think we can go ahead. It looks like people are happy with the clarification. Let's go ahead, Minister, if there's any more thing that you needed to.
Well, the second part of the MPRCA, which we will be talking to, is a presentation or a briefing on the Principal Act. And this is because we will appreciate that the chairperson is a new chairperson, and when he got into the portfolio, there were hearings on the royalties bill, and they wanted them to have an understanding of the context, which is the MPRTA, and that's the reason why then they requested us to come and do a workshop kind of thing so that they are well appraised of the Principal Act. and I will then allow my officials to take them through the MPRPA. I'm not sure if members of the media will be interested in that. They've seen it before, but if they are interested, it's fine. You're most welcome.
Just to start, Minister, and then I will get the other officials to actually talk about this. The request was around contextualizing what the whole Act provides for and possibly, therefore, the areas that needed to be amended in order for us to get, you know, to get to the part where we say we have the B10B bill that was agreed to last year. And by that time, then I'll ask my colleague to talk to that one. For a start, I don't think that we need to go back thoroughly into what it provides for, but we know that in terms of Section 2, we've got a thoroughly set out section around which contains the objectives of this Act, which talks about the transformation element, environmental protection, inclusion of women and HDSA people, which is SIM transformation, the issue around custodianship of mineral wealth of this country, and as well as the issue of improving economic development, ensuring economic development through the development of mineral and petroleum wealth of South Africa. That is still there, and there are no amendments as far as that section is concerned, and it is quite critical that we mention here that in terms of implementing the law, that Section 2 is a very important one in guiding the process leading up to granting or refusing any application. And then we've got also to jump from that to the transitional arrangement, which members and the chairperson, and I'm certain that you're aware of, that we had three periods of this conversion of the transitional period. The first one came and went, and which is what led to the whole backlog issue that ran from 2005 to almost the end of 2006, because we didn't know up to the end of April 2005 how many applications to expect, and so our planning was a bit out of line because it was anyone in this country who was supposed to apply. But be that as it may, come to the end of 2006, the backlog was wiped out and we had a system, and we said to South Africans, we communicated that every month we'll publish information on applications received and applications, you know, finalized and applications in the process. So on a monthly basis, we've got that on our website where we indicate applications that are being processed and those that have been granted and finalized. As you know, within the department. And also we indicated as part of that the specific periods that are applicable to applications. For instance, when we're talking about mining permits and prospecting rights, we're talking about a period of 6 months that we actually meet that period. We receive an application, we process it, and by the end of 6 months, we then are ready to issue the specific rights. And then in terms of mining rights and production rights, and, you know, the petroleum ones, we're talking about a period of 1 year, which includes a 180-day period for the EIA process. And then we've got the other issue that is of critical importance is the issue of beneficiation. The Act provides for, you know, beneficiation that the minister will allow, or people need to apply, companies need to apply to send raw material out of the country, and the minister will take action against that. But as we began and continued with the work around beneficiation and the strategy that we're working on, we realized that that section was not enough to cover what the policy sought to achieve for South Africa, and hence, therefore, the section around beneficiation is part of the amendment section of this bill to indicate and to actually cover the work that is being done, you know, around the strategy. But I am not at liberty minister and chair. So over the strategy at this point, is it still a matter for cabinet discussion as we work on it? And then there are issues around the granting sections, the section 17, section 23 mainly. And section 17 contained also in section 17 two issues around people competition issues. How do we grant prospecting rights? Do we need if you have a lot more a number of applications, how do we deal with that? So that therefore we ensure that we open up opportunities for those who were previously disadvantaged and would not apply. But that is still there in terms of Section 17.2, and it's something that needs to happen, because otherwise if we amend that and we remove that from the legislation currently, we will be hamstrung and not be able to extend the opportunities to other people who may want to get into the industry. And Section 17.4 talks about also issues around Section 2, the involvement of HDSA, in prospecting. That has been an issue that, has been in the public domain and media around EEs, as they are termed outside, being involved, and therefore the issue of investment being affected. But it's something that we need to retain. We've said that it's in the Act. We need to retain, because for people to enter this industry, it's not enough to get in at the point of mining. Prospecting is still an area where young geologists, where HDSA people, women, and others need to get involved, no matter how risky, but they still come in to actually get into the project at that early stage in order for them to get, one, the skills, but also to get the benefit of what comes out of that process when the prospecting ends and possibly ends on a positive note, where mining operations can begin. Section 23 talks about the involvement of HDSAs. It refers back to sections 2, D, and F, and therefore the whole issue around South Africa demanding BEEs comes in. It's not about it's not a section that we are looking at amending, because transformation, as is stated in the objects of the Act, has got to happen, and we make it one of the conditions for licensing. It's in the Act, and we've got to make sure that right from the time that the right is granted, the industry is aware that BEE is in, and we've seen that many BEE deals have been struck, are part of the application processes and the right that have been granted, and we believe that we're doing fairly well in terms of bringing in those who would otherwise not be owning anything within this industry. Jumping from there, we also have the mining charter, which is provided for in Section 100 of the Act. And as we all know, that the broad-based socio-economic empowerment charter is in place, and it provides for a number of things. And now those pillars, there are 8 pillars in the mining charter. But those that we really use when it comes to licensing and then monitoring and the processing of, as well as the process of just setting up mines, are 7. And that would exclude beneficiation, because that one is on its own, and we're still trying to ensure that all our ducks are in a row around that one. So the 7 pillars of the charter need to include ownership, human resource development, employment equity, community development, and others, 7 of them. We now have them as part of the social and labor plan, which is part of the whole application process. And now there, applicant for a mining right and a production right, not the other rights and permits. If they send in the application, they send in the social and labor plan indicating how they're going to do, you know, human resource development within the company as well as in the hosting community where they're mining. But also we're talking about employment equity and the issue of women and HDSAs and the targets that have been set in the charter to be achieved by 2009 and beyond that. And therefore, when we're talking about this discussion that took place earlier around environment, for us, the issue of granting or processing applications is very integrated. We're looking at the application for mining or for producing petroleum in such a way that we don't forget issues of environment, issues of development, community development, and people within the mine. So that is the social and labor plan. We're talking about ownership, the transformation thing, which is part of the charter. We're also talking about health and safety, because then the mine health and safety inspectorate has got to, you know, to comment and to give us an indication whether that mining operation should be granted a right or not. And so that is why it took us some time to get to a point where we agreed with DEET that environmental provisions can go to NEMA. But still, we're saying that with that having been agreed to, we need to remember at all times that this is an integrated process for minerals and energy. Hence, it makes it a bit difficult to actually think of it separate, but then with the whole thing around the Minister of Minerals and Energy being a competent authority means that we can at least have our hand in it, that it's not just about the environment, but it's about the economic development, not only of the country, but also of the community where the mining operation is taking place. But it's also about health and safety, and it's also about ownership and transformation. As we grant a right, we grant it on the basis of all those integrated factors, which is very important for us at the moment. I said earlier that we have the transitional arrangement, and I spoke about the first part of it, which was the first year, unused old order rights. Then the second part of it, going back to it now, was the issue of the prospecting rights, the old order prospecting rights. That one had 2 years, and that 2 years ended at the end of April 2006. And so whoever had any prospecting right that was valid and being used immediately before the 1st of May 2004 had to come in and convert that right, that old order right, into a new order prospecting right by the 30th of April 2006. So that period has come and gone, and we saw quite a number of applicants coming through there in excess of, in quite a number of them, but I think that if my memory serves me, they were in excess of 350 that came back to us. And now we are busy with the process of granting new rights and processing new applications on new order rights, but also the final leg of the transitional period, which is converting old order mining rights. That period ends on the 30th of April 2009. And there are some, you know, milestones that should be achieved by then. You know, the charter talks about 15% of ownership, for instance, by 2009, and beyond that, 26% by 2014. And so we're preparing for this final leg, you know, final year on this, and we can see that possibly some companies will come on the last day of the last month, but at least we know the numbers that we're expecting, and we don't foresee any problem with it, because we know exactly who's supposed to come back to us and do the application. It's just that if they're not coming through now, it may well be that by the time the April starts and ends, we will be having quite a number of applications coming through to capture the last day and the last month. But we prepared for that as well. I think
by you, Chairperson. I think we should allow you to maybe just pose questions. The only thing I can talk to is relates to the beneficiation strategy. That the beneficiation strategy did serve in cabinet. But there was, as we had observed in the department, there's a very tight overlap between us and the DTI in as far as that strategy is concerned. We observe that it's part of the industrial policy. Beneficiation is part of the implementation of the industrial policy, which is a responsibility that falls within the jurisdiction of the Department of Trade and Industry. We were then asked to go and clarify this overlap in terms of locating the beneficiation strategy. So we are busy with that process. Surely it will serve, and we'll come back and report to the portfolio committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. I'll allow members to interact if at all there are still any areas of clarification I offer. So if not, then we can continue. But I just want to find out something, just one thing. In terms of this beneficiation, don't you think that probably we must now demand more than just giving the companies to think what they can do, at least something where the communities should have some part of ownership to those particular, say, mines or whatever operations?
I think that there is nothing, Chairperson, that stops communities from really becoming member, you know, shareholders in operations within their community. It is just a question of economy. Can they afford the shareholders? And it could well be that even though they have minerals in their vicinity or in their area, they are not really geared towards mining themselves or becoming miners. But in order for us to make sure that they benefit somewhat from the extraction of minerals on which they live or within which they live, the social and labor plan is being promoted to ensure that there is local economic development. We work with municipalities, local municipalities, because we cannot just talk to communities anyhow. But we say that if a local municipality has an IDP, our assumption as the other arm of government is that that IDP includes the wishes of the local communities. They know what the IDP contains. The municipality has consulted them on the projects and the programs that are in IDPs, and hence then we say to applicants, for you to talk to communities, to actually look at what your neighbors in that locality want and need and have planned for as development, you need to look at the IDP. And so on the one hand, therefore, there is nothing that is in the law that says they should not participate, but it's just a question maybe that they cannot afford or they are not yet towards it. But in terms of what we can do as government, we then use the social and labor plan much more so to make sure that there is that local economic development. But again, the mining charter provides for ESOP. But that covers only the employees of those mines. That we, you know, it is one area that mining companies can use. It is one aspect that they can use to ensure that the employees benefit from ownership of the minerals that they are extracting from the ground. And so we say that they can go for the ESOP, the employee share ownership program, so that therefore the employees are therefore formed into a group or into an association that therefore begins to hold a percentage of the some of these the deals that have been struck between the industry and the new players, also including some of the employees, you know, as part of UFOP. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, what are you? Simple changes.
But I think we still have to conduct an investigation as the department on whether the companies are responding positively in terms of the social labor plan. Because if they are responding, of course there are some that are responding, but I think some kind of audit needs to be developed to make sure that there's compliance. We have spoken about this as we were observing that there is a bit of slowness in as far as conversions are concerned. As a result, it may well be that we have not done well in terms of delivering on the social and labor plan. It's a work that the department will be doing. I thought you should get that.
Actually, yeah, that's what I was trying to refer to, because I've observed that a certain debate in the television whereby, although it was not about mining, but it was about the nuclear power stations, I found that the people were at that, you see, there was the municipalities, there were for, they had all the things, but the communities around there were saying that they were not consulted, but the others were saying, the municipal authorities were saying, no, they were consulted. But this thing goes further even to especially local authorities, the chiefs, whereby the chiefs, these companies pay to the chiefs alone, and so it becomes something, a private position of one individual, which is what the minister is saying, that they must be, develop a strategy which ensures that not only one person benefits in the name of the community. You see, it should be the community as a whole that benefits. You see, that's a very important strategy which should be developed, kind of policy. So it's to know that at a certain region where this kind of operations are happening that are supposed to be benefiting people, that they really do benefit people, not individual leaders. You see. So I think those are kind of things that are very important to follow up. Yeah, I think, of course, Elizabeth, you want to say something else? Follow up, let's give you first.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson, I agree with the individual, but also you find that mining companies are coming there to mine. Then they pretend that the community around there is part of the workers there, yet they bring their own workers from elsewhere. That is also a disturbing factor that the community is going to do.
Otherwise, the employment does not benefit the people of the locality. Yeah, okay, I think so. Can you come closer? Yeah. Just, yeah.
Close 100. The Minerals and Petroleum Development Act. Close 100. On transformation of minerals. My question, therefore, is the first subsection 1A saying that after consultation with the Minister of Housing, the Minister of Minerals and Energy must develop a housing and living condition standard for the people. I'd like to know, this must happen 5 years after the Edward amalgamation. I'd like to know whether we have reached that yet or not. Then secondly, on the issue of beneficiation and the industrial strategy, I'd like to know whether we are the only department that is affected with beneficiation that now has to deal to work together with the industry on the industrial strategy, or rather other departments also who are doing beneficiation who are affected as we are. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. The issue of employment benefiting local people, I think that we may well have to distinguish between skilled and unskilled workers, but at the same time, this is more the industry, the holders of rights, you know, an issue in terms of who they employ. But there are times which we have also considered to where they need skilled workers and they cannot find them in the local communities. And in that way, it is not easy for us to insist that they get even the skilled workers from the communities, because then they can't find them. But we still say, through the HRB part of the SLP, Social and Labour Plan, that you need to do the training of young people in those communities, the training of their own employees there, you know, career pathing within the company and the employment sector within the company, mentoring, coaching, because what we believe in is that even if there is still one person who is maybe near retirement, etc., who is still in there, if that person mentors, coaches, you know, the young people that the company needs to attract and should be attracting from the local community and from elsewhere, because we can't really contain it to the local community in case there are no skilled people. But we still think that if they implement all of these, you know, these steps that are in the Social and Labour Plan, we could do something about raising the skill levels within those communities so that people, young people, don't just grow up, you know, seeing mines, but do not have the capacity to get in there and do and carry out the functions that are carried out in a mine simply because they are not trained. Hence, therefore, the importance of the Social and Labour Plan. Therefore, we're considering that in many cases, it's not local people that are working there, and that should be changed. In terms of transformation, yes, Section 100 also provides for the housing and you know, living standards, and you know that the minister should be coming up with the standards in consultation with the Minister of Housing. As of now, which is something that you will hear about in due course of this the coming term, we are engaged in a process of assessing where we are and where we're going. We're looking at the whole mining and mineral policy of 98, the review of that. We're looking, therefore, at what is contained in the MPRDA, what is being done, and whether we have implemented everything that is contained in the Act. One of these issues is Section 100, and we have looked at the housing and living conditions standards. And it's something that we're busy with as a department, and we're hoping that come the end of this coming financial year, we would have communicated with South Africa around this thing. But again, to the honourable member, the 5 years is only ending in April 2009, so we have this period until then to report on whether this has been achieved, and we're working on it already.
I just want to add something on the housing, to say that some of the residences of our mine workers really are
cannot live in such conditions. I've been to some, mines, and I've seen the residents of the mine workers. There is some improvement in some mines, but it varies. There's still some laxity in some. We've raised this with the industry very sharply. We have a tripartite arrangement where the DME sits with the industry as well as the National Union of Mine Workers, the unions. So we did discuss this matter we raised it with them very sharply that they have to make sure that they improve the living conditions. Dauduna, for an example, is one mine that I went to, and Mupuneng is the other, where things are relatively better as compared to other mines. But I'm saying they are not yet there. You still have a situation where about 4 to 5 mine workers share, you know, and it's not habitable. It's an area that needs improvement. Really, we have to concentrate on that. On the people, the workers being recruited from outside the mining area, I think the leadership, the local leadership, has a responsibility in as far as that is concerned. Of course, they get workshopped by the Department of Minerals and Energy on how to engage the companies with regards to offering employment to the locals. I think what is unfortunate, which is maybe is to a certain extent what Puti has referred to, is the fact that the training that comes with the MPRPA as part of the social labor plan, it comes after the effect. For an example, and it makes it difficult, and I'm going to illustrate the point that I'm making here, it makes it difficult for the locals to take advantage of the opportunities that would come with mining in their area. For an example, procurement services. If people were trained and empowered before the companies started operating in their area, they would be empowered then to take advantage of those opportunities, especially from procurement services. Because it's about cleaning, it's about catering. But you find that in some areas, and we should not take this for granted, in some communities, I've been just made aware of Lipalale, for an example, deep, rural, very few people are skilled in the area. And, I mean, you need to train them for catering. You can't take it for granted. Even if they can cook, like, food until it is fried and ready. But catering is a business. It's an industry. You can't just take it for granted. So I'm saying maybe we should then look at whether we should not bring forward such training so that by the time the company starts operating, then there will be people who are there who are ready to take advantage of the opportunities that would accrue, that would come with the establishment of a company there. Again, it depends on the local leadership to look into that. We can assist in terms of workshopping them, but the local leadership, local government in particular, has to ensure that people are trained to take advantage of them. And we are engaging local government.
Thank you, Honorable Minister. You have
okay. Yes, just two issues. One is, do I understand correctly that there are no outstanding applications for prospecting or mining rights or mining permits? Because I've seen figures which indicated that one of those classes of applications, only one application was approved. Now, I'm not sure whether that is a fact, but if so, it sits very uncomfortable with the fact that you say if you kind of marble company took the Department of Government to court to the International Tribunal in Washington, I believe. Yeah. What's the position? What's the point we are at the moment? Thank you.
To the Honourable Member, the issue around that statement which was in the media about one application granted in a whole quarter was totally untrue. We have responded to that because it really was not true, and when we looked again and again at our statistics, the period that was quoted, it certainly wasn't true. And it's also just almost impossible, you know, in a period of 3 months to only grant one grant. You know, if I don't know where they got that information from, we battled to find the source of that kind of information because our statistics proved otherwise in the department, so we're not sure where that came from. But in terms of outstanding applications, I think that South Africans seem to understand it even more, that you apply now, and if you send in an application in March, you've got to wait a period. You'll be getting correspondence through the period. First one would be within that, you know, that 14 days that indicates that your application has been accepted or your application has been rejected, whereupon you need to reapply if you still want to. But if it has been accepted, then you're told you've got to do this and this, you've got to, et cetera, et cetera. And so people do know, those who have actually applied, that this is the process and it's going to take me this much, because then if I send in this and then they'll take 2 months consulting with the other state departments, and thereafter they tell me to then provide financial provision, and thereafter you're waiting for a decision of the minister whether the right has been granted or not. So maybe South Africans still need to get more into the knowledge around the process, that they understand that they don't just send in an application and we forget them and only remember in 6 months' time. We actually do communicate in between. The second issue about the Italian case, I don't know to what extent I can use the legal terminology of sub judice here, because that is what is happening at the moment, that it is sub judice. Safe to say that the arbitration process is on track. The first sitting was in December 2007, and beyond that, the process is sub judice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the input.
On the application, applications, well, the Italian case is responded to adequately. So, I must say that we had some our own people representing us as the MEP going to London, all of that process, but that's where it is now. But on the applications, the tendency of applicants is that when they submit an application, they think that submission will translate to approval, even if they don't comply. Whereas submission means that just that you have submitted an application, which we still need to process. And if you don't comply, we reject. And unfortunately, people do not report that we did not comply. They will say we submitted in December. They won't even acknowledge that there was correspondence between the time of submission throughout until at the point where they decide to talk publicly about the matter. So it doesn't come automatically. Sometimes they use that to force us to approve, even if they don't comply. And more often than not, the culprits do not comply with the social labor plan, with the BEE, and with the environmental management plan. And for us, those three are sacrosanct. If you don't comply with any of these three, or with one of the three, we don't.
we don't issue, and that's it. It's a condition. And on that one, we are clear that we will not approve if you don't comply with those. So it's also an issue of compliance, which really is not, it's seldom spoken about. It's more, it's taken as an administrative failure on the part of the DME. And yet there's also a compliance issue here, a serious compliance issue. And if anything, I would really at some point want to demonstrate to South Africans and this portfolio committee the kind of documentation and the size, volume, one application, you know, it's about three boxes that people, seriously, I've seen it. Because, I mean, I had these complaints from my officials in the regions that, Minister, we are understaffed, we are undercapacitated, we have a limitation, we can't process this thing. And I wanted to see, but an application, I mean, I know what an application looks like. I thought it would be a two-pager, and I found that it's volumes and volumes that you have to go through. Surely you can't go through one application in 2 days. You can't. I can assure you. It doesn't matter how fast a reader you are. Because in the course of that, you are also looking at these matters that are legal, which are part of, which are legal requirements within the application. So it's a tedious process as well. But also the compliance issue is always underestimated, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it's a very useful day today. We really understand issues more than I'm sure Honorable Smith will be very happy, because it's been the person saying that he would like to be clarified in, you know, on some of these issues. Yeah, I think I'll ask the department now to clarify us on the MPRT royalty bill. We had some interaction with the finance committee, and we found that, well, they were very difficult figures to understand how it happens, double taxation and things like that. We need to be clarified if the department can. Thank you. Over to you now.
Thank you, Chair. I think that this issue arose out of the presentation that particularly the company, the BS, made at the joint sitting of the portfolio committees, this one and the one on finance. The issue revolved, well, the way we read it, because we are, if I must just state it right from the beginning, that we don't agree with what the BS said to the two committees. And because I will just read this, I'm not sure if I should, because we did prepare some documentation for members if they wanted to get some. I can just talk to the origin of this lease consideration that we're talking about. That is also referred in our transitional arrangements. In terms of an old proclamation of the early 1900s, the state was entitled to a majority participation interest in any proclaimed timberlite diamond mine. And the mine that they specifically referred to in their presentation, Finch, is also a kimberlite mine. So the state held an interest there, and the interest of the state at that point, I mean up to now, is actually 70%. But then because the state could not get into mining, maybe let me just say that then in 1964, the state then entered into a lease of the state interest agreement with the PS. That was in November 1964. And it was entered into in terms of Section 38 of the now repealed Precious Stones Act of 1927. The state is therefore entitled in terms of that lease to this 70% undivided share in the ownership of the Finch mine. The state agreement is still in force. It continues in force until it's abandoned by the company or terminated by both parties. In terms of Clause 4, it says that in consideration of the rights leased by the state to the company, the BS is under contractual obligation to pay to the state a share of annual profit derived from working the Finch mines according to a formula stipulated in the lease agreement. So whatever payments the BS was paying or is still paying now, it is based on this contractual agreement that they had, that they still have with the state. And that is not a royalty. It is a consideration for them taking up the 30%, the interest of the state, actually, the 70% and using it, that they are paying for that. It's like you're paying rental, rental money. It's not a royalty. It's more like a rental that you're paying for using someone else's property. The royalty is you paying that on something else. So now there is this formula that they are using that is part of the lease that on the basis of which they've been paying all along, and they continue to pay for this mineral lease that they have, the lease that they have with the state. Clause 5 of this lease states further that the BS, in addition to the share of profits payable in terms of Clause 4, shall also pay to the government such amounts as are payable at any time under any law for the time being in force. Now, they knew right from 1964 that at any time, if the government sets out amounts that will be payable to the state under any other law, they will be paying that. So the royalty bill as proposed now is also part of that, any law that would be in force and under which they'll be paying some money to the state. Just to go back to this act, in terms of Section 70, which is the state share of profit of the mine, now Section 70 of that, repealed Precious Stones Act of 1977, the state was entitled to receive 75% of profit of a mine proclaimed on state or alienated state land. The state was entitled to it. So whatever they're paying, it's part of that entitlement to the state and not this royalty that they're now saying that it means that they'll be double taxed. However, the state, in terms of Section 74 of the Precious Stones Act, the state was empowered to lease that interest to the company who was entitled to work the said mine. If the state then leased its interest in a mine to a person who was entitled to do so, it could do so subject to conditions agreed to between the parties. Hence, I said earlier, this was a contractual arrangement between the state and the BS, and they've been aware of it as such that this is not a royalty, and hence we also provided for it in the MPRDA. Now, the lease consideration referred to then when you go to the MPRDA transitional arrangements in item 9.7 of the transitional arrangements of the MPRDA has got to be read with the context of the state's share of profits referred to in clause 4 of the lease of the state's interest in the Finch mine. And that must be read together. Section 37, I know that I'm raising an act that has been repealed, but it is part of this contractual agreement, and that's why DNE does not agree with the presentation that the BS made, because we believe that this payment that they are making is more akin to a rental than it is a royalty. And so when they do this, make this payment, it's because the state actually owns 70% of the operations there. But we have leased that to them, and hence they're paying back to the people of South Africa on the basis of that 70% that they have been given as a lease from the state. So it is not in any way in conflict. You know, it doesn't in any way result in them paying two royalties, because this one is not a royalty. I mean, at any stage, the state can just, you know, also say that this 70% it can give to somebody else, okay, and that person or that company would still be paying that amount, but now it has been given to them on a contractual basis, so there is this contract that we cannot just, you know, terminate without negotiating with them, and we cannot also say to them, stop paying this consideration because it has really got nothing to do with the royalty. That is the view of DME on this matter. I have circulated a whole, you know, a three-page document which we brought with us the other week in order to indicate to members of the House, of the committee, you know, our view on this matter. Thank you, Chair.
Just some clarification. What was the contract that was repealed in the repealed law? Was it about that contractual agreement or something else? I just want to get a clarification.
The law was repealed, but it continued. This one, the lease, you know, the contract was not terminated. The contract. And they then even applied for a mining license in terms of the repealed Minerals Act. And so in terms of item 9, sub-item 7 of the MPRDA Schedule 2, we have catered for those circumstances such as it exists on Finch Mine, that there is a state interest there, and there is therefore a lease, and that they need to come back and convert that, as they have applied for conversion, by the way. And if they meet the requirements, it will be granted soon, but if they don't, we can't refuse it because it's a conversion. But still, they are paying on the basis of the 70% that was given to them per that contract that was signed in 1964.
One member, the Honorable Ngale, and Honorable Msabala.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to know this lease, Mr. Bill, forever. When is it going to expire? Can't we use this facility to ensure that we broaden participation? They've been missing from 64. I was also born in 1964. So that agreement is as old as I am. When is it going to expire? Thank you,
Chairperson. Mine is very short. The first one is, what normally happens when somebody comes and misrepresents the facts to us here in Parliament? Because I was there when there was this public participation, and the very same question of dumped taxation came up. But now with this explanation, it is very obvious that De Beers knew what they were doing. And it becomes a very bad thing when people would find us as people who are not responsible enough not to see something that is wrong. But the other one is understanding that the royalty bill is the responsibility of the Finance Portfolio Committee. But I wanted to know as to the involvement of this, of our department in this regard, especially in the crafting and to the response of the queries that came up from the public participation.
I'll allow the response from the government.
doesn't have an expiry date. That's why it's important that they pay for this, the 70% that they were given. And therefore, it's a contractual thing that they need to continue to pay. The second question is not for me to respond to. But the third one, in terms of the royalty bills and the involvement of DME, the DME was consulted because, as we will recall as members, that the DME is up to now collecting royalties. There's still some, those that who are still holding old order rights, who are still paying royalties. So the DME has been collecting royalties over time on state minerals only. Now, with the change of regime in 2004, therefore all minerals became state, but then therefore there was this sort of suspension of payment of royalties for new entrants, for new applicants, and for new holders. But those who are still going to convert up to 2009 April, some of them are still paying if they were mining on state minerals. So the DME therefore had the knowledge and the expertise in terms of collecting, but now it's going over to finances. The member has pointed out we were consulted, you know, through the drafting period, and DME did participate. But at the end of the day, it was, it is the bill of National Treasury, and the substantial changes, I think that the participation of DME towards the last bill that came out in December had really diminished at that point, but initially we really provided as much as we could in terms of information around the collection of mineral royalties. In terms of responding to queries, those that would be directed to DME, we will respond to them, but generally I think that since the public hearings were, you know, those of the National Treasury, they retain the bulk of the responsibility in terms of responding. But we are available to assist with the responses if they impact on, you know, if it's on the information that is within DME domain. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I can talk to the. Maybe trying to respond to the question that Ms. Ngaleka raised about broadening the participation of mainly the black people that were excluded in the industry before in terms of ownership of the minerals. I just want to remind the portfolio committee that we have an arrangement. We entered into an agreement with DBS, whereby DBS at present is giving us 10% of its total production, and it goes to the state diamond trader. In other words, those minerals then become the property of the state. I'm just trying to get the period over which this 10% is going to increase. And the understanding that I have on the agreement is that we are finally will be getting the total production in line and in accommodating what is happening now. So it does, to a certain extent, address the issue that you have raised. I'm not responding to that.
Thank you very much. I think, as you said, the other point is a point where for the committee to consider if a person comes and misrepresents facts. I'm sure it's not for the department, it's for Parliament to check what should happen, how we could remedy the situation. Without wasting time, I think it's a very, very useful exchange of these facts. In fact, when we discussed with the chairperson of finance about this royalty bill and the argument raised by the PM about double taxation. You know, today this is very, very clear, because what I said to the chair of finance, I said we have to check, because the chair of finance was saying that it seems this double taxation happened even before 1994. It was always there. So they are taking it as a new thing now with us, they are being double-edged, but they have a certain agreement they made even with the old government before, and they've been paying it. And then I said to him, we have to establish what was this agreement based on and why. And today I think we have been clarified now. I think I'll be able also to share, because the finance chair was very much disturbed about this thing. But I think this clears everything now, where all these things come from. I think we must continue now. I think we have exhausted this. It's very clear, this royalty bill thing. I think we are now on top of the situation after this clarification. So I think we can continue. I thought we were still to be briefed by other legislation, issues of legislation.
Well, Chair, as I said earlier on, we will be talking to the three pieces of legislation that we will be piloting, but we can't give you the detail. We will talk to the intention of the bill and the objectives of the bill. Well, intention has carried in the objective. And I will ask, he's vanished. Oh, he's coming. I've got the DG Gumede here to talk to us on the energy bill. Maybe while he is still making himself ready, I will talk to the National Radioactive Waste Management Agency bill. The purpose is to establish the National Radioactive Waste Management Agency. It will be responsible for management of radioactive waste disposal on a national basis on my behalf, on behalf of the minister. It will be owned by the state, so it's a state-owned entity. Why are we doing this? It is regarded as international best practice in the nuclear sector to have an agency managing the disposal of radioactive waste. Generators of radioactive waste cannot be entrusted the duty of also managing waste disposal. So it's also to ensure that you don't have a referee and a player in terms of the people are generating radioactive waste. Then an independent agency frees the generators of waste to concentrate on their core mandate, be it power generation, R&D, isotope production, and so on. And countries that have these agencies, which are independent agencies, include France, Spain, Hungary, Canada, Japan, Belgium, and so on. The functions of the agency would include the following. The design and the implementation, designing and implementing disposal solutions, develop radioactive waste acceptance and disposal criteria, assess and inspect the acceptability of waste for disposal, manage, operate, and monitor operational disposal facilities, manage and monitor closed disposal facilities, investigate the need for any new disposal facilities, site design and construct new facilities as required, define and conduct research and development aimed at long-term radioactive waste management, maintain a national radioactive waste database, manage any ownerless radioactive waste on behalf of the state, assist generators of small quantities radioactive waste in the management of their waste, provide information on radioactive waste management to the public living around disposal facilities and the public in general. Of course, there is a control and management of the agency, similar to all others, and the chief executive officer and so on. Funding, just like any state entity, it will be funded by Parliament, appropriated by Parliament. Well, the rest is really all what should be familiar in terms of how governance in the entities would apply. The PFMA and all of those things. I am deliberately minimal in my presentation. As I said earlier on, this still has to be discussed by Cabinet. But I thought that given that we had promised to come and give you an indication, and the fact that we don't have much time, we should give you a sense of what we'll be taking to Cabinet.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. I will allow members if they need any clarifications on this matter. But I just want to find out I know that NEXA has been running the Farabus repository in Northern Cape. So this agency is now going to take over and they will manage that repository. And another thing also what is very important in the management, waste management, nuclear waste management is, as it's partly said, is to find there must be a strategy that the agency must deal with the communities by, because they call it management of social perceptions. And that's what they have achieved in countries like Sweden to really regulate and win the social perceptions of the public and develop with them. Just it's more of a comment than a question, but for NEXA, I think that's a very important development if there is a special agent. Actually, in most countries, they've got these agents, as as you have said here. And then their waste management practices are far better than it has happened. There was a time when a car was seen around Japan which was carrying a lot of radioactive fuel, and you see, and you do not know what havoc it can cause, and so forth and so forth. I think it's a very important development to have an agency of this nature. But it must be manned by also people who will understand exactly these issues, because if by anybody, we may find cars running around anywhere with radioactive waste in public places. Without wasting time, I'm going to give members to interact if they need any matters of clarification quickly. But as you said, this is a piece of litigation that is still in its pipeline. We wouldn't get into the details of them until they have gone through the cabinet. We still are not in possession. It's not the possession of Parliament, it's still a possession of the executive. Once then they have passed it on to us, which I hope, according to the time frames, should be somewhere in May and June, if I'm not mistaken. That's how the time frames have been given to us in town. Of course, the Mashaba there, then Galega, then Honorable. After Mashaba, it is.
No, Jefferson, just the one on understanding that this agency will be funded through Parliament on its activities. But just checking as whether there would be expected charges to those who would be using this facility through the agency, and also as to where would be the tariff regulation be lying. Will it be with the same agency or it will be somewhere else? I'm looking at probably that they would also be generating some income besides that they would also be counterfunded.
Honorable.
I would invite
Santa Gumede to talk to us on the purpose of the energy bill. And Santa, you will be very, very minimalist. You just concentrate on the objective. Because it still has to go to sleep.
Talking about
There's a clear assumption that you have a lot of energy to be able to do that, especially some minerals like chrome, which you can't do anything about, chrome oxide, except if you put electricity through them. It's also about issues relating to import and export policies, how much of South Africa's, for instance, primary energy needs will be covered by our imports. How do you deal with neighbors in respect of exports? For instance, in liquid fuels, when we talk about South Africa, we normally refer to South Africa plus the BLFN countries, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. We also, energy security is about diversity of supply. Again, in respect of diversity, it's not just diversity with respect to the energy carrier itself, but diversity in terms of the sources, standards and specifications. Clearly, if you're using an inefficient appliance in respect of energy, that it affects your energy demand. It's about climate change, partly because in respect of energy, energy itself affects the environment, but it also itself is affected by environment, especially when looking at issues of water supply. That in some areas where you might have a power plant because you've got adequate water supply, in 30 years' time, with climate change, that water supply will not be available, which will then might bring to an end the life of that particular plant. It's about foreign policy, of course, clearly. It's about having the right relationships with the right countries. It's also about production. How much of local production links to the imports and exports? How much of South Africa's primary energy are you going to be reliant on imported products versus what is produced locally? And lastly, it's about reserve margins. We use the term from electricity side, but reserve margin is really about the excess over and above what is currently demanded. It's about policies which relate to that. So essentially what we say, when one talks about energy security, it's not about security of supply. It's much broader than that. So the energy bill, essentially what it then does, it gives effect to that. And the way we define the energy security in the energy master plan is that it means a diverse energy resources which are available in sustainable quantities and at affordable prices. Available to the South African economy in support of what we're looking at is that it's going to be in support of economic growth and poverty alleviation. But of course, taking into account the environmental management requirements and interactions amongst the economic sectors. So essentially, energy security is really about, it's about resources, but they must be available in sustainable quantities, but clearly it's about the prices. If it's not available, if it's unaffordable, it is not available. And whatever that we do must be in pursuit of economic growth and poverty alleviation without forgetting the environment. The second purpose of the bill is really to establish institutions that are supporting the bill, but the institutions are in respect of promotion of efficient generation and consumption of energy. It's about energy modeling and planning. It's about increased generation and consumption of renewable energies, energy research, and what we term contingency energy supply. And, of course, it's about holding strategic energy mineral stocks and provide for adequate investments in appropriate upkeep and equitable access to energy infrastructure. The last purpose for the bill is clearly the most important that was asked by this House, question was asked by this House 2 weeks ago about why you're using data that dates back to 2002. It's because at this stage there is no obligatory supply of energy-related data, and this bill aims to correct that by providing measures for the finishing of certain data and information. But I think the point I'd like to stress here, Chairperson, is that
in respect to what people might call energy data, is that especially when we're looking at it in respect of demand, supply, and generation of data, that is cross-cutting. For instance, coal is a mineral, but coal is a primary energy carrier. For instance, water is water, but it's used for other purposes, like agricultural purposes. But you will not be able to produce electricity without water. Steam turbines, for instance. Assume that you've got water. So there's a whole lot of issues. So when we talk about energy data, sometimes people might expect we're only talking about how much electricity is there and how much liquid fuels is there. But all of those things are produced from something. And all of that is used for something. So we're looking at both the supply side and the demand side, as well as everything else in the middle, which is the infrastructure, and which transport and generates that electricity. It also provides for other matters that will be explained in the bill itself. In drafting the bill, it's important, because of the fact that energy is cost-cutting, that we spell out clearly for people to understand that the bill does not seek to replace existing institutions. As indicated, I mean, energy, like water, it actually happens to be an economic integrator. We only really see this when there is absence of energy. In 2005, when there was no liquid fuels, our life comes to an end. You can't even get bread because bread is delivered in trucks. So, energy, like water, is an economic integrator, and we call it energy is the lifeblood of any economy. And therefore, that being the case, and whenever economic decisions are made, they must be made. They must never be made without consideration of energy availability and price. And it's also important that we need to. The bill is focusing on issues really intended to strengthen energy security. The way we say it is that this bill will operate in much the same way as the competition law operates in the space of competition. When we talk about, so there might be areas of concurrency, which sometimes are very uncomfortable. On data, the idea is not to start. Get people to provide data which they already provide to another institution of government. If, for instance, there's data that is collected by Statistics South Africa, the idea is not to actually start another process of collecting the same data. So the bill itself will aim to facilitate a level of sharing of data by institutions of government. In establishing institutions proposes establishing a number of institutions. In establishing those principles, most of these entities are intended to act as advisory or executing agents for the minister, but they will only act on the mandate for which they were created. What this allows is to avoid creating entities with conflicting mandates. What we mean by that is, for instance, in the past, the integrated energy planning has been used to drive agendas, be it renewable energy agendas or whatever the agendas might be. So if you're planning, it should be planning. It should be, or at least on the modeling side, it should try to avoid having entities, having mandates for entities which are conflicting. A lot of this must really take only into account only published government principles and not be driven by private agendas. It might sound straightforward, but you'd be surprised. And the constitution of most of this on the government side, we are looking to say in some of the cases, in most cases, on the government structures we have the government ministries, but in some cases it may include representatives of industries as may be prescribed by the minister, and especially on the part-time members. But the bill itself is arranged in the following structure. Clearly, chapter one is it was purposely written in chapters so that we'll be able to take out the chapter in the event that we needed to actually create a separate piece of law for a chapter, for an entity, for instance. But the chapters, chapter one about definitions, clearly chapter two focuses really on provision and access to data. Chapter three is about energy modeling and the agency that's created in respect of that. Chapter four focuses on energy planning. I'll explain the different chapters in between how we see energy modeling and energy planning. Chapter five focuses on energy, on renewable energy. Six, energy efficiency. Seven, energy research. Eight, security of supply. Nine, energy infrastructure. And clearly, 10 is the provision for regulations and all other issues. So that's how the bill is structured. When you look at the bill itself, and as I indicated, chapter two, it really looks at mandating provision of data and information. It also looks at, say, how it creates an avenue where there will be connection, there will be any connection for creation of a connection to energy and information management systems. The idea is that that should be within the public service. But in the previous bill, which has been canvassed with the stakeholders, there was also a mention there of possibility of interacting with outside systems. So it's something that we'll still need to engage with the stakeholders. It talks about safety, health, and environment. Clearly, Chairperson, this is not about getting again into the space of the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. It's really about it's looking at the energy aspects of the environment. For instance, in 2006, we introduced clean fuel specifications. That was in respect of the Petroleum Products Act. There could be all other aspects in respect of either the energy carrier or the infrastructure that looks at the safety. Environmental aspects thereof, which will still have to be under the domain of the minister. It also looks at energy access by households. Again, this is remnants of the past, so we will still need to look at that and see whether it's not adequately covered somewhere else. If we look at the bill, it talks a lot. There's a big section which is really essentially what we're trying to create with this. Is the ability to allow the minister to make informed decisions, not just the minister, but the minister, cabinet, and also public, to make informed decisions. So it talks a lot in chapter 3 and in chapter 4 about energy modeling and planning. And this is informed to a large extent by the liquid fuels crisis of 2005 and the current electricity crisis, I guess, the one of 2006 and 7. Essentially, what it recognizes is that we've got a number of plans within government and state-owned entities, but in some cases, they've got contradictory activities under the same plan. There is really no integrated or coordinated view of the energy sector, but which is important for the sector because not only are the sectors interlinked? For instance, take at the moment we have an issue that electricity is being generated using diesel, something that was perhaps not intended to be, it was intended to be for peaking only, operating at 5% load factors, but these plants sometimes operate up to 50% load factors. What that does is that, for instance, to indicate Jefferson, is that the Mossel Bay plant produces largely petrol, but it produces a significant amount of diesel and which very clean diesel, for that matter, very, very clean diesel, something like 10 ppm sulfur diesel. And at the moment, about a third of all the output from Mossel Bay plant is going to supporting the OCGT, which is sitting in Mozambique. What that does, it puts a lot of pressure on the liquid fuel supply. So whatever decisions that are made on the electricity supply have a bearing and an impact on the supply of liquid fuels. And I'm just quoting the one in Mossabay, but the one in Atlantis is the same things are supplied by NGN. But at least the ones that are around the coast are better suited in the sense that they perhaps infrastructure to be able to import product specifically for them. But it's important also when we talk about energy security to think that when most of those LCGTs were designed, they were designed with a specification for product which we don't have in South Africa. And that is important, that it's only when before they started operating that it was impressed on the operators that if you're asking for that type of fuel, we don't have it in South Africa. You would then have to import, but you know, in terms of explaining, it became clear that they actually didn't quite meet that level of fuel specification. The point I'm trying to raise here, Jefferson, is that in terms of the energy sector itself is integrated, and we need, when we're looking at it, to look at it in an integrated fashion as well. So the way we've looked at it is that and this slide is an important slide, Jefferson, where we're trying to, in this slide, explain the difference between energy modeling and energy planning. Within what we say in modeling really is about, it's an instrument of trying to mimic mathematically the behavior of the economy and put up and write it by form of models, so that to be able to predict its behavior, to be able to forecast how the economy will look in the short, medium, and in the long term. That modeling, we believe, should always be informed by what exists, not what we wish to have. We call it, therefore, a modeling which would be based on a policy neutral energy information. By that, I want to explain what that means. When we say policy neutral, is what we're saying is that when policy already exists, that's the only policy that is included in the model. If, for instance, in respect of technology, because we have a lot of people that will talk about, you know, it is always useful to listen to people talking about that we'll be able to supply with a 50 by 50, I guess the number was 50 kilometer by 50 kilometer solar panel, we would be able to supply the whole of South Africa's electricity needs. While that might be the case, what people don't say is that at what cost? And also, not just at what cost, but reliability as well, and so forth. So it's the issue is that it's one thing to look at technologies which are still being created, which are not commercial technologies, and to then look and compare those with existing commercial technologies. So in terms of energy modeling, the policy neutrality relates to that as well. The only thing that is included in the model are technologies which have been tried, at least whose economic structures and related costs are actually known. And what we want to use that as a modeling for, like it's done in a couple of places that we've been to, US and to some extent Norway, those kinds of models are used to advise cabinet, national, local, and provincial government, and also to advise markets and the public at large to provide information. For instance, as an example, in the US, they publish every Tuesday what they call gas inventory. Before that, the price of gas is always like what happens with crude. Speculators come into it, and they will tell you how much gas is actually available, and therefore they will price it on the basis of that. But it's only when the EIA, the Energy Information Administrator, publishes data on Tuesday that they publish what the actual data is, and at that time the market corrects itself. So essentially that's what we're looking for, to have a tool for the market to be able to make efficient decisions. So it's about market. And then, of course, on the planning side, planning is different. The way we look at planning is that planning is a, the only thing we're looking at there is about integrated planning. But what we're saying is that planning is it allows for anyone to make a deliberate, take a deliberate action, which might not necessarily, which might be informed by a model, but not necessarily told by the model. The model just informs it. People make deliberate actions to say, we will have 10% of our energy, primary energy, coming from renewable. Therefore, that's, and that's a plan, and that's a policy statement. You just need to indicate where do you actually think that will come from, and in the energy modeling, we then take that plan and include it back in the model and actually model it. So I'm hoping Chapter 7 explains the difference between energy modeling and energy planning. So in the bill itself establishes what we call an energy modeling agency, which is going to be looking at collecting, compiling, and analyzing energy data and information. We'll publish that information as indicated daily, weekly, monthly. And we'll also provide annual energy reviews, and we'll also do forecasts. So that's what the modeling agency will do. And of course, taking this from the U.S. model, we would assume that also it would be asked to prepare certain reports. For instance, in the U.S., before they introduced their biofuel strategy, they asked the EIA to actually indicate to them what the implications were, which the EIA of PLA did indicated what the implications were in respect of their refining sector, in respect of crude, which they import, in respect of agriculture, land availability, and issues like that. But essentially, what the modeling agency will also be able to do is to prepare special analysis which the minister might ask for, or if anyone is developing policy and they want to test the policy based on the existing macroeconomic models, they will use this agency to do that. Okay. Then, of course, on the modeling, on the planning side, the bill looks at the development, or it creates an opportunity to develop 30-year energy master plans. At energy master plans, we've got a 30-year view. This must always be produced in an integrated and coordinated manner. What we mean by that is that, for instance, in developing the energy master plan, like the one we did last year, clearly we should have been able to take into account transport plans as much as we should have been able to take account all the beneficiation plans, all the macroeconomic plans, finance plans, all those things, because all of them, collectively, they impact, they have some bearing on energy, be it its availability or its cost. And it must be informed by the output of energy modeling, but it must, as we indicated, must link to other plans from all demand, supply, and production sectors, whose plans are impacted or impact on this master plan. The way to illustrate this graphically, this is what we mean. I won't delve in that, and I won't take too long on this, but essentially what it is that the integrated energy planning, which will, whose output will be an integrated energy master plan published annually, would be itself in its development be influenced by all plans coming out of government, all policies and strategies, including infrastructure, which are coming out of government via this modeling agency. As an example, we just thought we'll show this one. It's much the same as the one that I showed previously. But all it is that the plan itself that will come out will be itself will have policies, legislations in the long term, and strategies in the meantime, and plans, technical plans in the short term. But this integrated energy plan itself would, when it was developed, would have looked at, for example, electricity plans, liquid fuels plans, renewable energy plans, housing plans, transport, etc. The bill itself then talks about, go quickly now, Jefferson, it looks at areas of renewable energy. It's really about trying to creating an environment which will be looking to create an environment which is which will enable increased consumption of renewable energy. As an example, they will create a system to allow for trading of renewable energy certificates, the so-called TRAC system. It will also allow, possibly look at legally creating the Renewable Energy Finance Office, which already exists within the department. But it will look at also at all other measures and incentives that need to promote the production, consumption, and investment in renewable energy. Energy efficiency, clearly in South Africa, it's been demonstrated that we are, at the rate at which we are growing, the consumption of energy is unsustainable. As an example, the demand for liquid fuels last year increased by 6.5% as opposed to what was projected as it was going to grow at 4.2%. We expect that this year it will be much higher than that because of people buying diesel generators and things like that. It is the use of energy is clearly not sustainable. So we're looking to create, firstly, an agency which will give effect, which will implement any program, energy efficiency program. And also, the primary thing is that we want to make sure that each energy carrier funds its own energy efficiency program. But the functions of NEA is going to be called National Energy Efficiency Agency, which currently, I guess, exists, but just created by a directive under the SAF Act. So it will now be legally created by the bill. The functions are clearly indicated there. Again, as indicated in respect of energy security, looking at the aspects on energy research, that there is a need for continued research in terms of energy. For instance, most people would ask me even people that are in energy, what kind of research would I be looking for in terms of liquid fuels? And my answer to that is clearly that we're perhaps not looking for an answer to replacing crude. That might be a difficult thing. But we're looking for an answer to replacing a vehicle, a means of mobility. And it focuses your energy research in that kind of direction. Because, I mean, the issue that one has to look at is that people were mobile, I guess, not as mobile before 1856, before the advent of the internal combustion engine. But the internal combustion engine came in many years, perhaps many centuries, after crude was discovered. So the idea here is that you need to have, I guess, an energy carrier which will then define the mobility going forward or the type of applications which are, you know. So for one, for instance, to be looking for a replacement for crude oil, it could be a wrong thing to be looking for, but rather to be looking for a solution to mobility. So those are the kinds of programs that this FANERI, this entity to be created, would actually be looking at. Then, of course, the other issue is about security of supply, inadequate stock. In 2005, the liquid fuels industry, it was indicated that instead of keeping adequate stock, they had about 3, 4, 5 days of stock, which meant that when one refinery went down, they didn't have enough stock to be able to keep the market supplied. I guess the same example could be used in respect of electricity as well, that those stocks that it would be useful to have enough water for hydro schemes, but to also have enough coal for the coal-fired power station and any other primary energy that might be required. And this bill is looking to actually create an opportunity to manage those stocks. And for security for the liquid fuels industry, it also creates an agency which has been researched, but it looks precisely, it looks really at the management of what is called the strategic stocks on behalf of government. course, on the infrastructure, it's really about coordination to ensure that in developing the energy infrastructure, that there is coordination between different energy carriers and between industry participants as well. In terms of the project plan, this is the last slide, Chairperson. We are hoping to have the bill approved by cabinet before the end of April. At which point, we're then hoping to then be certified by the state law advisor before middle of May, by then introduced into the House. Section 75 bill in the middle of May. We're hoping that it will. This is a plan that still needs to be discussed with yourself, Chairperson. But that is essentially where we're at. We've done the first draft, and we've interacted with other government departments. We have had a stakeholder workshop. We are now in the process of finalizing, incorporating comments from the stakeholder workshop in the bill, which will then be sent up for approval by the Deputy General and the Minister for Transition to come. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'll therefore, I think, because time is up now for lunch, and I understand the minister is addressing us until after lunch. Yeah, we will continue with you after lunch. And then we may close then. But the minister may still join us if she still so wish. But I thought that the minister has given us much of what she had today. I think after lunch, that was the last presentation on legislation. We will only discuss a few things, because even we can't be discussing this because it's still not here. But maybe people may want some clarification. I don't know whether they want us to just finish everything now so that we can probably I don't know what members think. What do you think?
And then talk members through a high-level content of the draft establishment bill, and deal with the regulations as well, and then just touch on some of the aspects around the consultation process. Chief? No, we didn't make copies. It's the REDS Establishment Bill, Regional Electricity Distributor Establishment Bill. Chair, by way of introduction, the REDS Establishment Bill will be the principal legal instrument through which the electricity distribution industry in South Africa will be restructured and REDS created. The intention of this piece of legislation is that it will lend consistency, transparency, and certainty to the process of EDI restructuring. It will be the piece of legislation that will look at merging the 187 municipal distributors for electricity together with Eskom distribution to form six regional electricity distributors. And each of these six regional electricity distributors will be anchored by the six metros in the country. We start the background of the presentation by making reference to a cabinet decision that was taken on the 25th of October 2006 that specifically approved the six wall-to-wall REDS as the final vehicle to implement the EDI restructuring. Cabinet approved that the REDS be established as public entities in terms of the Public Finance Management Act and that it be regulated by the Electricity Regulation Act. Cabinet also approved that Eskom will become a shareholder in the REDS for a transitional period. Cabinet noted that DME through EDI Holdings will oversee the establishment of REDS. And in particular, Cabinet noted that EDI restructuring legislation will be introduced as the legislative instrument through which the REDS will be created. Chair, this map is just meant to be a representation of the six REDS as they will be demarcated according to boundaries in the country. RED 1 will be anchored by the Cape Town Metropolitan Municipality. RED 2 will be anchored by Ekurhuleni Metro. RED 3 will be anchored by Nelson Mandela Metro. RED 4 by Joburg Metro. RED 5 by Itekweni Metro. And RED 6 by Tshwane Metro. In terms of the high-level content towards the bill, our drafting approach to the bill is that we recognize the current constitutional and legal landscape, and by this we make reference to local government's powers and functions in respect of electricity reticulation. We have framed the bill as a bill of high-level principles, and the intention is that the details will be covered in regulations that we will draft simultaneously with the bill and introduce in the cabinet and the parliamentary process. And later on in the presentation, I'll touch on what will be the aspects that will be meant to be covered in the detailed regulations. And then lastly, the approach we're following with the bill, because it is a piece of legislation that deals with local government assets in respect of electricity reticulation and Eskom's assets, is that the intention very much is that there will be extensive stakeholder consultation on the process towards finalizing the bill. Chair, then, moving on to the actual content of the draft bill. The bill starts by making reference to some of the principles governing the implementation of restructuring. And these principles we really extract from the Energy White Paper of December 1998, together with the EDI Restructuring Blueprint Report, which was approved by Cabinet in 2001. And the high-level principles that we aim to achieve the restructuring to take place within relates to a consolidation and integration of the EDI to ensure that we give effects to the benefits associated with economies of scale, greater efficiency, and improved access by consolidating the industry into six distributors. And then importantly, to strike an appropriate balance between national development objectives and the executive authority of municipalities mindful of the constitutional principles around corpus of government. Chair, the bill starts by declaring six electricity distribution and trading regions, and these are aligned with the map I showed earlier on. The bill will then provide for the creation of a new public entity to house each of these six distribution details around ownership control of the REITs, who owns and controls these REITs, national government's right as shareholder, including other shareholders that may have a stake in the ownership control of the REITs, the main powers and objects of the REITs, including its main objective, which is to distribute electricity, and then deal with the governance arrangements for the REITs, including the composition of the REIT boards and the appointment of the REIT boards. Then it will very significantly deal with the transfer of the ESCOM's electricity undertakings into each of the REITs on a date that will be stipulated by the Minister of Minerals and Energy by notice in the Government Gazette. The voluntary transfer of a municipality's electricity undertaking into each of the REITs on a date to be stipulated by means of a written agreement between the municipality and its REIT, and then the voluntary appointment by a municipality of a REIT as its service provider, and this is really to recognize a municipality's rights and also to give compliance to local government legislation that recognizes municipalities as service authorities over electricity regulation. The conclusion of standardized service delivery agreements, and this is really, again, to give effect to compliance with the legislation, recognizing that municipalities use a service delivery agreement as their regulatory instrument by means of which they regulate provision of a service by a service provider that they appoint. And then also importantly, recognizing the regulatory role of the National Energy Regulator in the country, who will issue each of the REITs licenses, appropriate licenses, and then the role of EDI Holdings as the implementation agent to oversee and implement the restructuring, and then provide for detailed regulations that the Minister may pass to give effect to certain of the principles in the legislation. The issues that are meant to be contained in the detailed regulations are as follows. What compensation will be paid to ESCOM and local governments in exchange for the assets that they transfer over to the REITs? What valuation methodologies will be used to value the assets, recognizing that different valuation methodologies have different impacts on the value of the assets and then ultimately the shareholding that contributing asset owners may acquire in the REITs? The formula that will be used for the allocation of shares to national governments, local governments, and ESCOM? The capital structure for the REITs, what financial incentives may be offered to local government to join the REITs within the context of a voluntary mode of restructuring, the transitional nature of ESCOM's shareholding, given that the Cabinet decision of October 2005 mentions that ESCOM will only be a shareholder for a transitional period, and then what mitigation measures we can put in place to ensure that the credit rating of both ESCOM and local government, the impacts on the credit rating are not adversely affected. Chair, then, by way of conclusion, to share with committee members, the consultation process on the draft bill since March 2007, the DME has engaged in extensive consultation with the Intergovernmental Forum, and this Intergovernmental Forum is made up of the DME, National Treasury, Department of Public Enterprises, and Department of Provincial and Local Government. In addition to that, the bill has also been discussed with the Energy Regulator, ESCOM, SELGA, and EDI Holdings. Consultations were also held with Labour. Presentations on the bill were made. Comments received have been incorporated to the extent possible. However, the consultation process is ongoing, and it hasn't been completed by any means at this stage. The consultation process for the development of regulations, recognizing that the regulations are really going to contain the core aspects relating to the EDI restructuring. We're also taking an approach that there has to be extensive consultation on the actual drafting and content of the regulations itself. The Intergovernmental Forum that I mentioned has commenced working on the outstanding issues. The intention is that due to the complex technical financial nature of these regulations, we would need to appoint transaction advisors to assist with things such as valuation methodology, shareholding formulas, allocation of shares, etc. And the intention is that the transaction advisors will report to the Intergovernmental Forum which will eventually produce the draft regulations, and the draft regulations will then encapsulate what we call the deal that will be offered to current asset owners in exchange for their assets transferring over into the REITs. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I think, therefore, if members want some clarification, they can interact with a board of presenters. I'm sure you'll be the first one attracted, especially with this red, since we're talking about this IPPs. Yeah, let me give you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. This is not working. No, I'm not going to ask in the red, so I'm going to ask in the previous presentation, if possible. Just with regards to the energy bill, I mean, it strikes me that this energy bill is more a kind of framework for decision-making, essentially. That it looks like that's what's been put in place through this energy bill. So making sure we've got all the ingredients ready to kind of make decisions about future planning. Well, what concerns me, though, is that, you know, we had a critical juncture in our energy planning for South Africa, and the decisions we make now will probably live with us for the next 30 to 40 years. I mean, decisions around what power stations to build and things like that. And I've been concerned that there seems to be three processes. There seems to be the integrated energy planning, there seems to be the public enterprises process, and there seems to be ESCOM's process. But to my mind, it seems that ESCOM is, at the moment, making what seems to be unilateral decisions around what they will build and what the future energy generation is going to come from. What kind of authority will this particular bill have in terms of bringing that into line and making sure that ESCOM is not allowed to simply make unilateral decisions about this, but that it has to be subjected to certain consultation and participation? I mean, that's my first point on that front. The other issue that I thought that you possibly missed out in your briefing when you talked about the factors that need to go into energy security, I thought one of the factors is also job creation. Because if we are going to be spending 1.3 trillion rand on expanding our energy generation in this country, that's probably the largest public procurement that has ever been spent in the history of this country. And surely we need to be putting as another factor is how many local jobs will we be creating through such an expenditure. And I think that that's part of the cost-benefit analysis that also needs to go into these particular decisions that get made. I just thought I'd put those summary thoughts through.
Can respond.
Thanks, Chairperson. I actually will respond like this. Maybe start with the first, with the last question. The issue around energy security, as you mentioned, job creation. But the way we look at it is that when we look at the macroeconomic framework, we would like to include not just things about GDP growth, about all those financial numbers that people look at, but it's also the people numbers, the people issues. It's about issues of how many jobs are created, what is the current level of the level of poverty. In the spectrum of that micro, on the micro group, which is, I'm not sure, I'll put it up here and I'll show you perhaps whether it's still, but it's an aspect that we are actually looking at. We're looking and saying, In planning, if you make a decision, for instance, whether you want to support a certain type of energy carrier or you want to support a certain industry, it's not just about its contribution to GDP that counts. It's about the number of jobs that it creates. It's about where those jobs are created. Because if you could just look on a numbers basis that you're getting rid of 20,000 jobs, but you could be getting rid of 20,000 jobs in a very critical part of the country, because that's where the jobs are actually located. So in our modeling, the idea is that we should be, these models would be linked to a particular geography, they would be linked to a particular industry. So when we're looking at the macro side, we're looking at all of those aspects. So, yeah, clearly those are the issues that we will panel a bit as we develop the model further. And rightfully so. If we are talking about, for instance, if you're introducing a new, if you're making energy investments, in making those energy investments, you are introducing South Africa is spending those trillions of rands that it's going to spend. The question that you're going to ask is that, are all those trillions going to go out to Germany and places, or Japan, or are those trillions going to generate economic activity in South Africa? And you've got to be able to model that. So essentially that's what the modeling is about. But to answer the broader question you asked about this bill being a framework of decision making, the one aspect of it is the energy modeling and planning, which, if we're being honest with ourselves, South Africa, we haven't put as much effort into developing an energy modeling capability. We've been making decisions, some of which have turned out to be very good decisions, but they could easily have turned out to be the other way. For instance, people might complain about the food prices, maize price in the U.S. going up, has gone up tripled, doubled, whatever the price might be. But the one thing that the U.S. did, it made that decision, it made a conscious decision. It was alerted to the possibilities of the price going the way it did. It was alerted to the implications in terms of what would happen to refineries, to the type of crudes that they're importing. It was alerted to how it will impact on the fuel specifications and therefore availability of fuel. And it made a decision like that. It was an informed decision. And the question that we'd have to ask in South Africa, how many of such informed decisions do we make? Are we too late? I guess that would be the question. I would have to say it's never too late to start. Yes, there are certain decisions that are going to be made, and in the next 3 years, critical decisions are going to be made. For instance, even us on the liquid fuel sector, for instance, we might be looking to have a coal to liquid type operation, perhaps being placed up in the water bank, or even wherever it might be placed, but it's got to be closer to its source of fuel. The question we have to ask is that, yes, it's one thing what the people, the company itself, that might be wanting to have that project passed, approved by the powers that be. But do we as the South African economy understand the implications in terms of what it means for climate change for us? Do we understand in terms of what it means in terms of our water resources? Do we understand what it means in terms of infrastructure? In the sense that it's going to be located far up north where it might be and the fuel demand might be down south. Do we have an understanding of all the implications, both in terms of human, social, and economic implications? And I think if we're honest with ourselves, the answer to that is, to some extent, yes. But most of that is decisions, or is based on assumptions and personal understanding, not so much numbers driven. So in respect of Eskom decisions, as we indicated, once that plan has been approved, to which some of the Eskom plans would be plans, and whether those plans have been adopted by NERSA as in the National Integrated Resource Plan, but once those plans have been adopted, there's very little that this system will do. All it will do is indicate the implications. And it's on the basis of those implications, I guess plans being plans can still be changed. But hopefully, even with those changes that might be necessitated by a proper analysis, those changes would not be just stamp-fact decisions, but would be changes based on numbers. And that's all we are trying to get South Africa to develop an ability to make decisions based on numbers.
Yeah, and I thought it was you who had asked the question. Oh, it was a follow-up. Oh. Jenny, your hand was up. Yeah,
Chair, I just wanted to understand the rates. You know, when the argument about the rates was on the table, it was argued about the efficiency of the rates, that the supply of electricity in South Africa would be more efficient if we offer models of the rates. Now, this question we've been asking in the past, and we're not yet clear, that given the status of ESCOM, given the status of supply of electricity in South Africa, are we going to be able to benefit from the rates as expected, because already the supply is there with its own problem? So will we see the efficiency of the rates given the status of supply of electricity in South Africa?
You can continue.
Okay, thank you. I mean, referring back to the energy plan or the energy bill, the energy bill seems to imply as well that we are able to model what's the best kind of energy carrier for South Africa and what decisions need to be made about that. Now, this works in a situation of a kind of monopoly control over energy to a large extent, which is a system that we've basically got right now in terms of ESCOM has a monopoly on generation to a large extent. I mean, there are some independent power producers. The issue as well, which I'd like to bring up, is, I mean, is this bill also going to be looking at future options in terms of opening up that market? And if it does that, I mean, is it then going to allow the market to decide what particular types of technology should be brought on stream and shouldn't? See, part of my problem at the moment is that I feel that unilateral decisions are currently being made by ESCOM around what our energy future should be. Now, you know, ESCOM's got its own agenda, and that's fine, and it's deciding that. Whereas if we had to open the market more in terms of such a thing as feed-in tariffs, for instance, and enable independent power producers to come on stream without having to sell their energy to ESCOM, who keeps it under control, then we might see a very different energy scenario in South Africa as well. I mean, is this something that the bill looks at as well and opens up those kind of options in terms of diversifying energy supply in South Africa too?
You can mark the question, because I've got some also few questions to ask. Matibela, and then Matibela.
Thank you, Chairperson. I saw the map that was on for the race. There are two parts that doesn't show. I just wanted to know what part of the red is going to service those green parts there that doesn't show anything. Or is it still going to be a problem? Is it going to be said it belongs to the local municipalities or to what?
I also have some questions, if there are no other questions. First, I was a bit concerned why you chose the wedding policy neutral modeling. Because when you describe it, to me it's not neutral. You said it is modeling that is informed by what you are buying. So I would have thought that it could have been, it would have called policy-based modeling, or policy-directed modeling, something like that, because it's directed by what exactly you understand. Not about hearsay or about predictions. I mean, it's a baseless predictions. You said you want to develop modeling of what exactly you have, you know, and you can do. So if it is neutral, I do not understand why, but I would like you to tell me why you call it policy neutral model. And then you also talked about many agencies that you intend creating. I can say it now that I think what you are saying is a very, very brilliant initiative in terms of saying that you need to have analysts, people who can model the future based on facts, based on tested numbers, and give direction to government. A very good example of what you said, that once even they take it, the government takes a very difficult position, but it knows what it is doing, rather than simply coming up and address piecemeal situations of the difficulties of the time. So I think that's a very good development, but I'm worried about many agents, because once there are many agencies that you create, you then dilute the effect of what you want to achieve, because then there starts competition, each one wanting to direct things his own way, to not wanting to be consulted with others and so forth. Then it then automatically destabilizes the whole purpose, probably, which was once a good purpose. Whereas if you have a divisions in one agent, that this division deals with this division deals with that, then you will achieve the purpose, because there is some central control of the agency. But once they are independent entities, then you are creating again problematic situations. I'm saying that because of a very also informed experience from the agencies, that many agencies that do not coordinate their things, even within the government departments, where you find that an agency like this is doing exactly what the other entity is doing, but they do not coordinate, and they don't want to coordinate because each one wants to do things, to develop his own kinds of business ventures. So I'm worried if you have too many agencies are under different roofs. And then there is also Saneri. Saneri, as far as I'm concerned, was I have discussed with people who were behind the development of Saneri. If you remember, it started as Neri, became Saneri. And Saneri, they had said that it was going to be responsible for all for the renewable energy development, because nuclear and other things like fossil-based electricity already has the institutions that deal with it. So they had said that their aim of developing Saneri was to develop energy research based on renewables. I'm not sure these agencies that you were talking about, how much would they be working, their working relationship with Saneri. And I'm not even sure how much Saneri has achieved up until now, or where is it now in its progress. And then there was a May workshop in 2001, which was similar to the type of this agency that you're talking about, but it was just a workshop. And so there have been some decisions that have been taken. I was part of that workshop, and the very advanced decisions were taken there about energy. It was energy audit of South African transport fuel. And a lot of brainstorming resolutions were taken there. I still have the booklet, but none of those decisions were implemented, which is exactly what you're saying. That even if you can have an agency like this, we need to. It has to have teeth so that it can implement decisions. So that workshop had a lot of resolutions that were taken, but none of them was implemented. Actually, I was surprised when I found that it never even reached Parliament. So I'm saying, therefore, that these are some of the things. How are you going to be able, therefore, to develop a policy modeling institute?
I'll ask my colleague Rhea to respond to the Rhea's question, and then I'll respond to the others.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think there were two questions that related to the rate process. I'll answer the easier question first. I think that question related to, are the six rates meant to be wall-to-wall, or are any areas left out? I think my answer to that is that the six rates are, in fact, wall-to-wall. They cover each and every municipal jurisdictional area in the country. So no area is left out. At all from the map that I showed you. Then, Chair, moving on to the question around will EDI restructuring really achieve efficiencies, and will we be able to realize any benefits from the creation of REDS given the current electricity crisis and the challenges we faced with around ESCOM? If that is the way I understood the question, then the answer to that would be one of the objectives around EDI restructuring is to ensure that there are efficiencies in the distribution of electricity, realize economies of scale, and really improve the quality of service and quality of supply of electricity. I think given the current challenges around ESCOM, we must appreciate that the entire ESI value chain, starting from generation through to transmission through to distribution, affects the quality of supply at the end of the day to consumers sitting at home in their residences. The current challenges around electricity relate, as we understand it, to generation. However, generation impacts on transmission and ultimately on distribution. I think that one of the main aims and objectives behind EDI restructuring is to ensure that there is adequate investment in the infrastructure relating to distribution, and to ensure that asset owners invest properly in the infrastructure so that we don't have failures on the actual distribution networks and that lines don't fail us there when generation and transmission is working well. And I think that if we realize that benefit around ensuring that municipalities and ESCOM adequately maintain the infrastructure, we can mitigate against any disruptions on the distribution side. If we achieve that objective, then surely we will be able to improve the efficiencies and see some of the benefits that the white paper and the blueprint, in fact, spoke about. However, the benefits from EDI restructuring will not be realized in the immediate term. They will be medium to long-term realizations of those benefits, and I guess the process has to be managed and so that over time we can really reap the benefits around EDI restructuring.
Thank you. The issue around, if I continue on the energy modeling part, the issue around energy modeling and scenario development is that, and taking your concerns, Chair, around this term policy neutrality. But by policy neutrality, we mean in our case, existing policies and existing technology. Wanting to have as a base that the energy models are developed are based on reality, are based on existing technologies, are based on the existing South African economy. For instance, most people would like to have this economy as being a service-based economy. I'm sure almost everyone in this room, so we move away from it being a primary, an economy based on resources and primary input. We would like that. But to move from where we are to where Japan perhaps is, or Germany, is a process. And it is useful that when one makes decisions, one makes plans, that those plans are based on those realities. If the issue around having alternative futures going to, for instance, in respect of, instead of continuing in the same path of us producing electricity from coal and nothing else, or any other that have been proposed subsequent to that, one needs to be able to say, is that the only
outcome? Is this the only future we can see? We need to be able to develop alternative futures. But you need to be able to develop alternative futures based on reality, sound base, and then you can then say, but if we introduce this technology, and this technology could produce this type of energy carrier at this price, how would the future look like? Now, that is what you then use when you're developing plans. And it's on the basis of that that you then put a program to say, if we want to have this economy based on hydrogen, for instance, if you want to be able to produce hydrogen on one side and electricity on the side from the same type of technology, that you would then say it will produce it at this price, both electricity and hydrogen, and it will be of this reliability, of this quality, da-da-da-da. And then if that, once you have estimated those parameters, we can then clearly then define an alternative future. We need to be able to do that. And we're seeing the energy modeling facilitating that, facilitating the development of those energy of those different energy futures, which would then allow us to be able to then challenge whatever that we've been told, be it by ESCOM, by Sasol, by whoever. I'm using examples here. And also, if, for instance, we have IPPs that can deliver electricity cheaper using a particular methodology, or not necessarily cheaper, but cheaper in the sense that when you include all the other costs, be it social costs or whatever, the cost to the economy is cheaper, that you can also model. But it must all be based on numbers, so that you'll be able to justify it, and you know all of those numbers are based on certain assumptions. You'll be able to test those assumptions as you go ahead, so that you don't wait until you've got a full project having gone in a particular direction before you say, hey, I made a boo-boo here, when you could have been able to test the assumptions as you develop the project. And at any one point in time, you can change direction. And that's what energy modeling, that's what it facilitates. That's why Chairperson is going to be based on what we call. So the reason why we refer to it, I think we might have to find a different name for this, because also when the Energy Master Plan was introduced to Cabinet, it questions this terminology, policy neutral. The only point we're raising with policy neutrality is that as a baseline, you need to create a baseline which takes into account what exists, both in terms of technologies and in terms of strategies which include policies. But you need, it's going to be based on reality. It's always going to be a reality check, because unless you do certain things in your plans, you will not be able to achieve your plans, because the world will continue to move. You know, if a river is moving in one direction, if you want to divert it, you've got to put certain things to divert it. It's not that it cannot divert. So it's just that when we talk about this policy neutrality, is that we want to create a good foundation that says these are the policies that are embedded in this model. And it must be clear that when someone wants to propose a new policy, that new policy will not necessarily be incorporated into a base until it's been adopted as a policy. That's where the policy neutrality comes from. But we've taken your concern, Chairperson. We need to find the correct word to actually explain that, because that's what we mean. It's a real thing. The other concerns raised by yourself, Chairperson, around the issues relating to institutions. Point is taken, Chair. The bill does propose to create a number of institutions, but it's important to note that, for instance, Saneri, which you referred to and correctly point out that it was, when it first came, it was NERI, then it became Saneri. It's an entity just created under SERF. SERF is under the PFMA, is a Schedule 2B entity, which is a profit-generating entity. We've been creating entities within a profit-generating entity, which are themselves not profit-generating. It causes all manner of conflict. That applies to Saneri and applies to National Energy Efficiency Agency. All the bill is trying to do is to create those entities properly, either as legal entities on their own, or I think taking your point, Chairperson, which you used, maybe as a division of one entity. But the point is they've got to be legally, properly legally constituted so that they can, if there's a need for them to have their own boards, they've got their own governance structure. At the moment, the governance structure is not working as well as it could. So, but there are a number of agencies there. The challenge, Chairperson, I think where I guess in terms of the engagement is going to be, we know what needs to be done. It's more what would be the optimal vehicles to make sure that those things are done properly. And it's really at that level, as we engage with stakeholders and as we engage with the House Chairperson, that will be guided to then say, if there's a need to have one umbrella organization which has got different divisions, one looking at modeling, one at research, one at energy efficiency and all those things, we would most likely be able to do that. But I think we'll be informed by the process as we go forward. The issue around the current Sasanyere focus, again, the issue is that when you create an entity and you don't create it by law, you don't give it proper function, it then tends to take the shape of the people that are occupying the offices in the office. For instance, MINTEC's mandate is about research in minerals. Finally, it should be about research in energy. Unless and until a Saneri also takes the responsibility of saying it's not just about, the question is, unless a Saneri researches future energy, all types of energy carriers, who will research the energy? As we know that people have put it, crude will be running out in 40 years, in about 44 years. We'll run out of crude in 44 years. Before then, the price of crude is going to go at what it's doing right now, increasing and increasing. But at some point, there won't be any crude left. It is a non-renewable source. Yes, people have argued you can use biofuels. To be able to replace the current demand, I'm not talking about the demand that's going to grow. Currently, the world consumes about 85 million barrels of crude per day. To be able to produce that many barrels of crude per day from biofuels, there is not enough surface space on the ground to be able to do that, let alone the fact that you will then be competing with food. Even if you converted every piece of land we have just to grow these biofuels, there is not enough to even supply a half of what is currently supplied by crude. And it's going to grow. It's projected that it's going to grow from the current 85 million barrels per day to the tune of 105 million barrels per day by 2020. If that happens, we'll not have enough. We need to be able to someone research what are we going to replace, perhaps not what we're going to replace the crude with, but what are we going to replace the transportation with. Someone needs to embark on that. And who can that be? It can only be a Faneri. So it's got to be a mandate. Whether it's Faneri does it itself or it does it in collaboration with all other entities in the world which are faced with exactly the same problem, that's neither here nor there. But it's going to be a Faneri mandate, and that's what is captured in the bill itself. It doesn't focus on energy, on renewable energy only. And the relationship with the existing thing is really going to be the same entity, only it's going to be properly constituted. And I think the concern you raised, Jefferson, about the decisions taken by that May workshop of 2001 raises the issue that we've been looking at about even with the energy plan. As indicated, the energy bill aims to produce at least one annual plan for South Africa, which has got a 30-year view. What we're saying is that it's got to be a plan which has got teeth. If someone deviate from that plan, yes, in developing of that plan, would have taken all the other entities' plans. But if someone now needs to deviate, for instance, if we've agreed that as the country for public transport, this is the direction we are taking, and someone else in developing their own plans, they take a totally different direction. For instance, a direction which is based on crude. And for instance, the example which was used to cabinet when the energy master plan was presented was, imagine in 40 years' time, we have the biggest freeways in Joburg to be able to handle all the traffic between Pretoria and Joburg and whatever, all the freeways that we have from N1 up to N, whatever the numbers that we have. We've got, they are big, they can handle all manner of volume. 40 years down the line, there is no crude. So you'll have these beautiful freeways, these beautiful trucks, which are transporting now because we've moved all our freight from rail, we've moved it to road. We have the only transport that we have in terms of public transportation is taxis and more taxis and cars. We have all of those and no fuel. That's a very scary picture. But how do you change it? Because unless we actively do certain things, put up plans to shift this thing back, that's where we are going. Now, we need to be able to then, if we've agreed as a country, this is a general direction that we are taking, for instance, in terms of transport strategy, that we all hold our hands together and actually go that way. And if someone is pulling us to the other side, that person has to be identified and corrective measures being implemented. So yes, Chairperson, the bill has to have teeth in that regard. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much. Also, I just want to find out from rats. Rats are by virtue even of constitution and the power of municipalities and local authorities, how are you going to solve that problem? Because municipalities are also up in arms and they are threatening to take the matter also up. Should you? So how have you sorted out probably this kind of a challenge?
Sorry, Chair, keep coming in like this, but I'm really excited by this discussion, you know, because this is probably one of the first times I've heard people actually bring up the resource constraints that we face within energy. And I think that this is the high time that we start to discuss this type of issue. When I've heard one official tell me that, you know, fossil fuels will be with us for eternity, it's quite clearly not the case. And we have to start thinking of alternative futures. I mean, things are not going to be the same. So I'm very excited that at least we've got the start of this debate going now. And in terms of that as well, I just wanted to know whether the study in terms of the externalities of energy has been completed. I know that that was part of the integrated energy planning process, and I know that was stalled because it didn't have funding or something. I just want to know if that study has been done, because that obviously has to feed into this particular bill too. And then just lastly, I mean, we talk 30 years on, and that's certainly, I mean, I certainly support such an approach, because I think we're going to see massive changes within energy infrastructure around the world over the next 30 to 40 years. And I think what we need to avoid is locking up all of our financial resources in particular energy carriers, and then having no financial resources left over to actually take advantage of changes that could happen in technology. And now this is the problem as well when we discuss these things, is that these are moving targets, because the price of a technology or an energy carrier could come down drastically within the next 5 to 10 years. But if we don't put that as part of our model and put that as part of our assumption, we're going to get caught out on that one too. Now, just lastly, though, while we think 30 years ahead, we've also got to think 7 years ahead. Now, we're in the critical period. For the next 7 years, we're going to have this energy crisis, as we're told by Eskom. It is clear that we have to get energy generation from whatever sources we can get it at the moment. And it is clear that nuclear and coal is not going to solve this present energy crisis in the next 7 years. The issue is, are we looking at the next 7 years in terms of this planning about how do we encourage the market, even if we have to pay a premium in the next 7 years, for new forms of energy generation, and how can we use that to kickstart an industry and hopefully bring down the prices of those alternative energy carriers? This is interesting.
Yes, okay, no response.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the point that you raised is a very significant legal point that has vast implications for the success of the restructuring. We as the DME, together with EDI Holdings, have done extensive technical legal analysis of the Constitution and of various pieces of legislation, particularly legislation relating to municipalities' powers and functions. And in addition to that, we've also sought various legal opinions from senior counsel in the country as well. And, you know, our legal advice is that if you pursue a mode of restructuring that's based on a mandatory mode, in other words, you compel the participation of local government in the REDS, compel them to transfer their electricity distribution assets into the REDS, that would amount to being unconstitutional action, and the entire process could be legally challenged because of municipalities' powers and functions in respect of the electricity reticulation. However, the current mode of restructuring that we're pursuing now is based on a voluntary mode where we don't actually compel participation of local government. So the slides that I put up on the draft Red Establishment Bill are written on the basis of voluntary participation. So municipalities can elect to join the REDS by mutual agreement between themselves and the REDS. They can elect to appoint the REDS as a service provider for electricity. And by the same token, they can choose not to. And when they choose not to, it has vast implications for the success of the REDS and for REDS really consolidating and integrating the 30 to 40 odd businesses within their areas. And so we're really faced with a choice. Do we pursue mandatory restructuring or do we pursue voluntary restructuring? And right now we are on the path of voluntary restructuring. But I also would like to mention that voluntary restructuring in itself has many negative or adverse implications. Firstly, it's really unpredictable as to what level or number of municipalities would participate in the REDS. It's unpredictable as to time frames. You can't fix a time frame to say that within 12 months all municipalities would be transferred in. So the restructuring could drag on for years and decades, in fact. And this, in turn, has implications on the cost. So the cost of restructuring could also run into to many millions or billions of rands. So voluntary mode of restructuring is very risky. And until we decide to change our course and pursue a mandatory restructuring, if we at all do, municipalities' participation would really be voluntary and at their discretion. So as long as it's voluntary, we don't foresee that there'll be any legal challenges. However, suffice it to say that the restructuring process could drag on. Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson, honorable members. I think the issue, the one question that was asked by Member Failing on this one is this issue around the study on externalities. I guess what we've The study will be one of the many studies, at least three or four, that we'll be looking at when we model, especially on the climate change issue. I mean, we're looking and saying we know that some areas of South Africa are becoming drier and drier. And yes, we've had a bit of a wet season. The extent thereof we'll never know. It's amazing. As some farmer once said to me when I observed that, oh, this summer was one of the wettest seasons. He said, so how many millimeters of rain we get this year? And unfortunately, because I am one of those that just look at the cloud cover as far back as I can remember, I said, no, we must have a lot of rain. He said, in actual fact, we only had, quoted a number, 186 millimeters of water compared to some 220 last year. So please don't tell me this year was wet. And it's really about the question of measurement. So there's going to be a lot of such studies we're going to be doing. Externalities is part one of those studies. It's really about how much CO2 we're generating from each application, NOxes, and it's about where it's generated, how it's dispersed in the air, and you know, if there are communities around that area, you know, how many of them are actually exposed to that. So it's actually a very detailed study that must be integrated to this broader energy modeling system. Otherwise, it will be, yes, we'll have a result, but it will most likely end up with what happened. It might end up in the same position as that, the outputs of the 2001 workshop, which you just mentioned. So we haven't forgotten about it. It's only that we actually want to embed it into a broader energy modeling. And the issue around the next 7 years, I assume it's next 7 years in respect of electricity, it's the next 3 years in respect of liquid fuels, especially for the inland region. We don't really talk about it, but the inland region is faced with a crunch that says by 2010, before one of the pipelines, so at least the one pipeline linking Durban and Gauteng is completed, supply to inland is dire. But it's being managed. But in respect of electricity, I think the choices for South Africa, there are many. One of them, the first one is really this one, energy efficiency. Energy efficiency in terms of cost, and also what we can do now. You know, they range between energy efficiency and this in terms of cost from that and the OCGT. OCGT is the open cycle gas turbines. I'll talk to a bit about that. But in between, Eskom itself has started a lot of processes. One might argue it would have been better the process to have been started by someone else. But the bids are out for cogeneration, for instance. We all know that they've gone out to ask people to tender, those that believe they can produce any electricity from any source. Eskom has come out and asked people to come up with a bid to indicate how much in terms of megawatts and how much in terms of cost, and when can it be available, and in terms of the time of day when can it be available. So those things are out, and Eskom is managing the process. But some of them, unfortunately, are long-term solutions, especially because we've got a lot of these things that are relying on long-term lead items. That some people might believe that we'll be able to just combine because you've been sending out these gases, you can capture these gases and use a steam turbine and generate electricity. But you're going to get the steam turbine from somewhere. And if it's not available, if you only get it in a year's time or 2 years' time, that's how soon you can get it. But I think the one issue that I wanted to talk about is the OCGT, because I think we're not short of solutions. I mean, most if you go to most shopping centres in Joburg, they're all running their own generators now. So they basically when they advertise their shop, they say we trade even during electricity supply shortages. But what they mean is basically they're burning diesel. To produce that electricity from diesel, it's been estimated. I'm not sure whether people know how much they pay at their households. Some people pay about 40 South African cents per kilowatt hour. Those things generate electricity at something like 2 rand, 24 cents per kilowatt hour. So I'm talking about the most efficient one. 2 rand, 24 cents per kilowatt hour electricity. So it's not just about whether they are creating the potential of creating, there's a potential of creating a another crisis in terms of liquid fuels, but it's very costly for this economy if one is going to be, because that money, even if it's not paid for by Eskom in respect of its own OCGTs, but it's paid by the economy in the sense that that could have been tax, that it's money that could have been profit generated and could have been taxed, or could be value accruing to shareholders that's being burnt by way of diesel. So it's those kinds of things that need to be looked at. But there is a myriad of options which are available, but clearly some of them are more long-term than others. But the key one is energy efficiency, of course. At least. That's the one that we're all in control of. Thanks, Jonathan.
Which by itself is costly for government to maintain. So there are many options. So that's why you need, therefore, an institution like that which models all these things so that you produce better results. based on very efficient management of the affairs. Yeah. I think that's a very good development. Right. I think it looks like we have come to an end. I think it was quite a very brainstorming exercise. I think we've learned a lot today. I think this workshop to me has been very, very useful. When we come back next term, I guess we'll be on top of all these issues. We'll understand where things are. We'll understand the rights. We'll understand the agencies that are going to come. So I'm able to also to respond to people who ask us during the constituency period where we are. I think that's very, very useful. I think with that we can then say we've come to the end of today. And thank you very much for all members and all the way for the officials of the department from Pretoria here, including the minister is not here now, but you'll convey the message on our behalf as committee. Thank you very much. It was quite a very, very useful exercise. Thank you.